Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender. There's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken.
Hello, folks, and thank you once again for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the growing conservative conversation, and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And you can find the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.patriotjournalist.com, and also check out the Bard's Logic Political Talk website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com, and check out our pages there, including our Get Involved page, which has some wonderful organizations on there that can definitely use your support, as well as our page with our affiliates and sponsors on there, and we'll bring them up a little bit later. And also with our special guest page, which has a list of the guests that we've had on the show. And our guest tonight will be Peter Greenwald, and we will be talking about the right view of liberty, as well as his parts in the campaign versus Eric Cantor. And of course, we know that Mr. Dave Bratz has defeated him to move on to the general election against the Democrat Jack Tramiel. And we'll be discussing more of that as well. And so tonight we'll be talking with that. And also we will be discussing the Supreme Court's ruling on the for-profit companies not having to pay for birth control. So without any further ado, I will bring our guest on tonight, and that is Mr. Greenwald. Thank you very much for calling to the show. How are you?
Hey, Robert, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. Hey, Robert,
can you hear me?
For having me on? I sure can. I got you loud and clear. Just thank you so much for having me back on, and thank you to your listening audience.
Great, great. So just before we get into the questions, how you been?
Robert, it's been great. I guess the one word would be exhausted. It's been a challenging year in many regards, personally, and of course on the campaign trail, but well worth it. And I'm finally on break. Classes are out, and I'm out for the month of July, and so this is perfect timing.
Okay, great, great. And also I know we're looking to get Mr. Brad on the show, and we're looking forward to that. So saying that, first we will discuss your campaign and your endorsements of Dave Bratt, and you ran in the primary versus Eric Cantor, as we said, but later decided to leave the race in favor of Mr. Bratt. What led to this decision and your endorsement?
Hey, Robert, really I just want to start with, this – my campaign was not about me. The campaign was about duty, honor, and country, and living out our Navy core values, which are honor, courage, and commitment. As you know, Robert, I'm a naval science instructor. I run the Navy Junior ROTC program at James River High School, and as part of that, I need to always set a good example for my cadets in living out our cadet creed, which says in part that I strive to promote patriotism, become an informed and responsible citizen. So I really need to, I guess each of us needs to live that out in front of others. So, and particularly for me, in front of my cadets. So, in a sense, it really wasn't about me. And I've had the opportunity to share with my cadets my faith. And, the apostle, from the Apostle Paul's writings, it tells us this, that I will do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility I'll consider others better than myself. And I will look not only out for my own interests, but also the interests of others. So, you know, I just, by my faith, I need to live that out. So living out that faith, it just made sense on March 27th. You know, we collected our signatures. We put in that effort using any snow days we had to go out and get signatures. We gathered 1,200 signatures and a few loyal grassroots supporters. You know, we had that, but on March 27th, you know, after much prayer, deliberation, and talking with others to support the campaign, we just realized it made sense to drop another race. I mean, Dave Brat, you know, shared as many of our values and as he expressed in the Republican Party of Virginia creed, and we share a common faith. And it just at that point, it made sense that you know, so we both hold the Declaration principles and we both desire to restore a constitutional republic. That it just made sense at that point to drop out, that any anti-Cantor vote would not be split amongst two. So we're glad to do that. And, you know, I think the results prove the wisdom of that decision. I think as I've been able to reflect back on North Carolina Senate election as well as South Carolina, I think that kind of proves the point as well.
Yeah, certainly we also, a good point on that, as we've seen how the conservative vote was split up a lot during the 2012 primary, and so we see,
yes,
you know, that end up with Romney getting the nomination.
Yeah, I think so. I know personally, as I was, you know, watching the campaign, I was initially behind Michelle Bachmann, and at some point I think moved over to Herman Cain, and finally I think moved over to Rick Santorum. And I think you're right, if some of those true conservatives had early on banded together, I think we might have come out with a true conservative that would have rallied. I think particularly, I think it's important, the conservative Christian evangelicals, which we can talk more about later. But yeah, that's a key part of the well, the Reagan Republican Party, I think. I'll go back to that. We need to rally those all the different factions of the Republican Party, bring them together. And we could have done that with a true conservative. We'd rally behind one of them early on. But, you know, I think about the South Carolina race against Lindsey Graham. You know, I think there were like six candidates down there splitting the anti-incumbent vote, if you will. I know in North Carolina there was a couple great conservative candidates. Dr. Brannon, and I forget the other gentleman's name, but I think one was supported by it was a pastor supported by Mike Huckabee, and I think if one of them had dropped out and come out and endorsed the other, you know, we would have had a true conservative as a Republican nominee out in North Carolina.
Yeah, certainly. So that's definitely it. So tell us more about you know, the endorsement, how it went. Did you have, like, you get both at a rally or something, or how did that go?
Well, you know, on March 27th, you know, Robert, I had the day off. You know, I took a personal day. And even that morning I was debating, you know, should I go down and file with the State Board of Elections? Even then I was just still really thinking through that and decided not to. What I did was just ended up sending contacted, you know, I've been in contact with Dave, he's been talking to him, we've been talking to each other, you know, since he had announced in January, so we're like that 2 to 3 month period. So I was in contact, I sent mm-hmm. his campaign I posted publicly a formal letter that I had dropped out of the race and had formally endorsed him. So that's how that happened, but got a really great positive response, I think, from my fellow Republicans, and, you know, just, I guess, a lot of posts on Facebook, just really share it on my website there, Facebook website, campaign Facebook page, just a lot of, messages of appreciation that I'd done that and stepped aside and endorsed Dave, so that was a good thing.
Yeah, and I've seen some of the emails of folks, you know, and I kind of kept quiet about it, and I didn't really, you know, respond or do anything of that nature, just kind of watched. And, you know, I've seen some of the folks who were, you know, kind of, you know, urging you, I guess, you know, after a certain amount of time to do that, to, you know, put your support behind Brett.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of grassroots supporters. And, you know, I had one fellow just who's now the 7th District Chair, Fred Gruber. I was doing a radio interview over with the public radio station over at the University of Virginia campus. He drove an hour to come talk to me after the show to encourage me to, you know, step aside. So, I mean, yeah, those are true grassroots conservatives there. You know, really had a desire to see some change and realize that, you know, one of us had to, one of us really needs to step aside and not split that anti-Cantor, anti-establishment vote.
Yeah, definitely. It was great to see, you know, someone from the grassroots, because we also had Matt Bevin on, who was running against Mitch McConnell, and that was definitely a grassroots campaign. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get that one pulled through, but
yeah,
you know, we did see a victory here with Brett.
Yeah, and if we could, as a side note there, you know, how important it is right now, I think across the country, grassroots just rallied behind, for instance, Chris McDaniel down there in Mississippi. I think that, you know, true conservatives in the Republican Party. I know I'm now, thanks to the campaign and one of my supporters sponsored me to be on the Chesterfield County Republican Committee. Just I sent forward a resolution to our executive committee that you know, we should call for Senator Cochran to step aside. You know, we need to condemn those immoral, unethical tactics that were used in that campaign. So I think, you know, so this is a, yeah, really as grassroots, we really need to rally together across the country. I think the shows like yours, Robert, and you know, the social media, Twitter and Facebook, I think we can do that. So it's pretty exciting. I mean, you can be in contact here in Virginia with direct in contact with the Chris McDaniel campaign on Facebook. I mean, it's a powerful thing. I think we need to leverage that and call the Senator Cochran and Senator Cochran campaign and others down in Mississippi and accounts. You know, that's not right. And you disqualify yourself for public office when you do not follow a code of honor. So.
No, I certainly agree with that wholeheartedly. And I don't know how much time we're able to have you tonight, so I do have some other questions moving on. So, and of course, we are still looking to have you know, Mr. Brad on, and of course, other, you know, grassroots candidates we'd love to have on as well. So,
yeah, Robert,
and I appreciate your contact with them.
Yeah, Robert, I've done that. You know, trying to stay engaged as best I can, and have he came out and spoke at the Chesterfield County Republican Committee Monday night, and that was great. So I got an opportunity to meet his new campaign advisor, Amanda Chase. I think she's a true conservative, came out in support of him, although she had previously worked for Eric Cantor, I think back in 2010, when she saw that the... Yeah, real interesting. And initially that caused me concern. It's caused some of my fellow veterans some concern. But in talking to her, I realized that you know, she had, when he came out with the negative negative ads, which I was getting one every day in the mail, that you just came out and said, you know, that's wrong. You've mischaracterized Dave Brat, who he is and what he stands for. So, she's like a true conservative, fellow homeschooler, so I definitely related to that. And so I think I just pray that she does a great job for Dave Brat and his campaign.
Well, yeah, and actually I think it's a good segue, and you answered it in part. So I did want to talk about now, of course, you know, we'll have him on. We'll get his perspective on the campaign, but I'd like to see what your perspective of his campaign is. And you think it was what do you think was the reason he was successful in beating Cantor? And can he move that on into beating Trammell?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, I was kind of reflecting upon my own experience. I moved here to Virginia in 2009, Robert, and I became part of this Tea Party movement, this grassroots movement that brought the Republicans into power, into the majority in the House in 2010. I think that whole Tea Party movement was part of this. I became part of the Richmond Tea Party in this last 4 to 5 years. We had groups rallying up to fight Obamacare and driving up with strangers the two-hour drive up to the Capitol to rally on the mall. I think all that energy has been there and building. And when Eric Cantor did not, lead on issues like the debt, then I think that just even fueled the grassroots movement farther. So I just see those anti-establishment, anti-Cantor sentiments have been simmering since 2010. So yeah, that was a key part of it.
Yeah, hopefully it'll definitely, most of the primaries, if not all, I think they are over, and we're getting ready to get geared up for the general campaign. You know, hopefully we'll see those grassroots folks get into victory. And so what are your plans moving forward? Go ahead.
Yeah, if we have time, Robert, I think about four or five other points there on
go ahead.
On the success.
We have as much time as you want to give us.
Okay. I was thinking about the Dave came with some great, had great credibility as a candidate. He has a PhD in economics. He's been in this area, I think, 20-plus years. So he has some roots here. He had previously ran for public office. So, you had a credible candidate. And he also, as I, watched the campaign, they ran a very disciplined campaign. They had a repeated, consistent, strong emphasis on the Republican Party of Virginia Creed. I thought that was key. I think because that gave a that attracted both the Tea Partiers and maybe and other Republicans that maybe don't particularly align with the Tea Party. And at some point I heard him say, "I'm not Tea Partier Dave. I'm here to." Although he very much many of the Tea Party we align with the Republican Party of Virginia Tea Party creed. And that's where he brought the emphasis. So I think that was key. And at some point he got support from national talk show hosts, and then Laura Ingraham, I think Mark Levin, including there used to be a local talk show host was on every afternoon, local radio station, Doc Thompson, who's now with Glenn Beck, he had him on. So I think you had certainly that was key. I think in generating more support. I think in the end, he also got on with Brian Fisher. He's on American Family Radio Network, show called Focal Point. Also got on with Steve Dace out of Iowa. So I just think having the radio talk show host, that's just power. I think in the end, I think we also saw the amnesty issue became key in the very end, the last couple of weeks. I think that energized the base for Dave Brent. I think point five is that the Cantor campaign had like $5 million in negative ads, both on to my local Fox News radio station, station as well. Yeah, I mean there was a lot of right from the beginning that he's a professor. And he worked as an economic advisor to Democratic governors. Since so, in turn, he's making a false claim that he's just a liberal. Well, yeah, he's a professor, and yes, he serves on an advisory panel, but that doesn't make him a liberal, okay? No, he advised like any other economist would, trying to give predictions on changes in policy and what kind of economic growth that might lead to. So. That doesn't make him a liberal. So I think what that did in turn, all that negative advertising really brought Dave greater name recognition they might otherwise had. And then finally, I think his final point on that night at his victory party, he said, it's a miracle. It's unbelievable, I think were his words. And so I just like the point that I guess the final point, point number six I'd make, as Dave pointed, there's obviously, I think, God was at work, just like our founding fathers said at the last line of our declaration. It says, "And for the support of this declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." So I think Dave pointed to, God was at work here, I think, just bringing all this together.
And what are your plans in moving forward and working in your support of Dave and his run against the Democrat rival Jack Tramiel?
It's a great the Big Red One is a great motto, which I read out there in Fort Valley, Kansas. It says no mission too difficult, no sacrifice too great, duty first. I think trying to live that out. I just do whatever I can. I think just coming on the show tonight, that's part of it. Albert, so I just thank you for that. Just give me the opportunity to support Dave by being on the show. So I'll just do whatever I can. Definitely want to reach out to my fellow veterans, especially including those I met along the campaign trail. And I think really most importantly, reach out to my fellow conservative Christian evangelicals. I think that's key. So phone calls, going door to door. Definitely going to get a personal day on November 4th, Tuesday, November 4th, Election Day. Make sure I'm out there canvassing on that day at Midlothian High School where I vote. So that's what I'm going to be doing there, Robert. So definitely going to stay engaged and do whatever I can. I think we need to remember that it's going to take decades to restore our constitutional republic in this never-ending struggle for liberty. So kind of reminds me of that Reagan quote, that freedom is only one generation away from extinction. So we need to just continue the fight any way we can.
And this will be the last question about the Brad's campaign, and then we'll move on to our topic for this evening. What do you think makes Brett stand apart from Democrat Tramiel, and how he would make a better representative for Virginia?
Yeah, Robert, have you had a chance to go out to Tramiel's website?
A little bit. I was able to peruse it some, but I like to hear it from. Go ahead.
There's nothing there. I went there and I know it's just been a couple weeks since they didn't have the original. I think his name was Dickinson. He's just the wrong candidate, I think, for the Democrats. I think he's now trying to run as an independent. But then they had like this mini convention, I guess, within the 7th District Democratic Committee. They found Jack Tramiel out of Randolph-Macon, the same university that David Brad teaches at. But there's nothing on his website. So it's like a short bio, but nothing about his views, his stands on the issues of the day. So with that, Robert, all I can really speak to is the Democratic platform, and I think what we've experienced from the current Democratic president and the Senate Majority Leader. I just don't know what else to point to. Our governor, Democratic Governor Tim Kaine, I'm not really sure who to point to, but I'll say this, that I think what will set, given all that, given what I know about the Democratic Party and the current administration, I know Dave stands for the Constitution, that Dave stands for returning our federal government to the enumerated, defined, and limited powers under Article 1, Section 8. I know he stands for that. I know he stands for solving the debt and our deficits. I know he stands for the Bill of Rights. So whether that be our Second Amendment rights or Fourth Amendment rights or First Amendment rights, Dave's all about that. So I think those are the key things. I think also, Dave's pro-life, pro-family. I think those are the key issues that set Dave apart from Dave apart from any Democratic candidate. But given all that, I think James Carr, who I think you said you had on.
We had him on about a month or so ago. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's a Libertarian Party candidate.
Right.
I think, in a sense, Robert, I think he's going to pose the real challenge here. It's kind of like we had our governor's race last year. Ken Cuccinelli lost to Tim Kaine. in large measure because a fellow named Sarvis got in the campaign with support from, I'm thinking Soros, but I'm not sure now. But he had some outside support, had some big dollars, gets, I think, enough of the vote, the Libertarian vote, I think some of which may have gone to Cuccinelli, and enough to get him the victory. So I think similarly, although I think the 7th District is more conservative than Virginia as a whole, especially given the changes in Northern Virginia, that I think James Carr could be the key to victory here. That you need to somehow, because James Carr is, I went and found a recent interview on YouTube, and he's all about solving the deficit and the debt, just like Dave. He wants to end government intrusion in our lives. Well, I think he wants to get back to our constitutional republic. But I think where Dave breaks out with him be on some of the social issues, which I think ties in with the rest of our discussion tonight about liberty. That I think that that's where Dave would draw a contrast. So I think you need to do that in a bold, clear way. I think in this campaign over the next four or five months here. So that's my view of it right now. So.
Okay, Grant. And speaking of the topic, thank you for bringing it up, and we'll start on some questions with that. Is in today's information age, how far is too far for the government security apparatus? What would be an effective substitute for widespread snooping?
Yeah, good substitute. I was thinking about, it made me think about Islamic terrorists, that old question. It made me think about that we wouldn't even be asking this question if Al-Qaeda had not carried out the attacks of 9/11. We wouldn't be asking this question. We wouldn't be asking that question if we secured our borders and identified the enemy. President Bush, I think, rightly after 9/11 put us on a wartime footing, and we immediately went into Afghanistan to take out the Taliban, because they had supported Al-Qaeda. Language is important. We call it a war on terror, but this is not politically correct, Robert, but it's a war against Islamo-fascists. That's what it's against. It's against those who seek to destroy America. That could be those like the Muslim Brotherhood, those like Al-Qaeda, and those that have kind of sprung off from Al-Qaeda, like this ISIS over in that has tried to establish a caliphate, I think they call it now, that are in parts of Syria and parts of Iraq. So let's identify the enemy. And in doing so, you target the enemy, you profile the enemy, then you are no longer need to do snooping on all Americans. But we're unwilling, apparently, to get beyond political correctness. And let me try to define political correctness. We throw that term around. I think one way is we avoid truth because we're afraid of offending others. I think that defines political correctness. We avoid the truth because we fear offending others. So in part, I think that's political correctness. I think that's what we're doing here. We're afraid of offending others, so we don't identify the enemy. Well, what the enemy is not, Robert, it's not this. I don't think the enemy is the white 85-year-old church-going grandmother. I don't think that's the person threatening our national security. I don't think from my experience.
Not.
Right, but yet, why are then we snooping on all Americans? It's not the young Hispanic teenage son of a United States Marine Corps veteran who's attending a local high school. That's not who's threatening our national security, right? So, if we do two things, we put ourselves back on a wartime footing, which President Obama's moved us away from, and we treat the – let me back up a little bit here. I started to think of the Boston Marathon bombing, right?
Mm-hmm.
that wasn't a Christian. Who was that? I was a radicalized Muslim who had emigrated to America from Kyrgyzstan, and I went to Kyrgyzstan on my way to Afghanistan. You know, that's who that was. So we know you need to kind of understand who the enemy is and go after the enemy, not take away the rights of all Americans. Like, you know, we've got a history of doing this. Many Japanese had immigrated to America and were Americans before World War II. But what did we do? We interned Japanese Americans and took away their fundamental rights. Okay? I think in some ways we live in fear and we sacrifice liberty because we in turn value too much security. I don't remember who said it. You know, if you sacrifice your liberty for security, you deserve neither.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's my approach to that. We need to live as free men. And with that, we accept some risk. We have to accept some of that. But also, we need to identify the enemy and avoid political correctness, and in turn, restore the liberty to, our fellow Americans.
Then we got a couple of our panelists here on the line. I'll be bringing them in according to when they called in. First, we have Kelly. He's got a few comments, especially on the snooping portion of the question, and then we will bring in James. So thank you very much, Kelly, for calling to the show. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good. We had around 100 degrees here in FEMA Region 9 today. First, I want to ask, is it Mr. Greenwald or Mr. Greenwalk?
Hey, Wald, W-A-L-D,
Greenwald.
Greenwald, yeah.
Okay, okay, there was two spellings, Robert, on the... Anyway, all right, and thank you for your service to our country, which I know you were in Naval Reserve, and I'm not sure what rank you had received. I kind of chimed in earlier. I was helping some people, or I chimed in a little bit late. But, I'm very honored to...
Yeah, Kelly, you're welcome. It's a real privilege to serve. Always has been. So just all of my old fellow veterans, just duty. We live in the greatest country, I think, still in the world. It is, as someone said, the 5,000-year miracle. And just my way to, give back to those who made the ultimate sacrifice in the past. So just a privilege to serve our country. And, just the way I understand freedom truly is not free. And but thanks, Kelly. I appreciate that. And I spent 22 and a half years on active duty. So I should say 20 plus years on active duty with a couple of years of reserve time. So, but yes, thanks.
It's always an honor to my dad and brother were in the Navy, but it's always an honor to be in conversation with a vet that has served this long, and mostly. You know, they get it. They understand the Constitution that they are serving for and protecting, and so that's a really good thing. You mentioned the quote, and it's from Benjamin Franklin, actually, and he said, "He who would exchange."
Oh, see, I was going to say that. Go ahead, Kelly.
he who would exchange a little bit of freedom for a little more security deserves neither. And that was, you know, quite brilliant. The comment, I just wanted to get into widespread snooping. You know, this once again, the Constitution has everything covered. The Fourth Amendment, basically, you can get a warrant to wiretap whoever you want to with a judicial warrant. And we don't need a executive branch or Department of Homeland Security. Except I do like the Department of Homeland Security. I mean, they are the only government agency that really listens to me. I joke
that.
Around a lot. But, when they issue their own warrants, what kind of scenario could we have? Well, if it's political enemies, they could go ahead and issue the warrants, you know? That's why the founders put it in the hands of the judge. The judge does it, great. You know, if we're not having expediency, well, then hire more judges. It's not that hard, folks. So that way we would have our securities. And well, there was a judge who wrote in one of these great cases, I wish I could find it, but he stated the Constitution is good and appropriate, applicable in any scenario, peacetime, wartime, depression, or prosperity. And he just pretty much nailed it. We already have the mechanisms we need. And I just kind of want to clarify that option for you, even though there is people who would come in, infiltrate, and destroy our country within.
Yeah,
is my biggest concern, really.
I think about what we'd avoid if in our visa process, I think 60% of illegal, I think it's Numbers USA would be my source, but it's been a while since I've looked at it. I think the numbers are well over 50%. 60%+ of illegal immigrants are those who overstay their visa. So if we're just, enforcing our current laws, that would help. And then two, we know who we're granting visas to. And two, if we secure our borders, so we know who's actually coming into our country, we could do a lot to secure the liberty, the rights of all Americans, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, justice, as we say, justice protects liberty. Well, if you have lawlessness down there at the border, in a way, you have no justice, and in turn, you sacrifice your liberty of other of law-abiding Americans.
Oh, absolutely. John Jay was the first Chief Justice, and he discussed extensively how justice is important for security and prosperity and liberty. I wish I had time to read some of his writings, but he's very wordy, but yet when you read it, the sentence again, you're like, that was brilliant. So absolutely, I totally agree with you in that, the Latin phrase would be fiat justitia ruat calium, which is let justice be done, though the heavens fall. And I'm just glad you're really busy and doing things above and beyond the call of duty, if you will.
Well, I can't think of a better place to be here at 10:30 on a Tuesday night, my first full day of vacation. So, in the fight for liberty here, so.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. I did want to... I'm glad I got to listen to Dave Brad on Monday. I was down at a luncheon. The Republican Party is working hard. I think they're trying to, on principle, reach out to minorities. And they had a group of pastors, primarily black pastors, at a meeting. And Dave Brad came and spoke. But he did. He spoke to this. He spoke to the importance of the rule of law. And, for instance, protecting property rights of all kinds. I mean, just how that all, the rule of law protects liberty, and then you have prosperity. Dave, I think, did a good job of talking to that on Monday at the luncheon I was at. So looking forward to him hearing more from him out there on the campaign trail, speaking to the rule of law, justice, and liberty and prosperity.
Yeah, I don't want to take any more time other than Whidbey Island. I've actually been up there in the San Juan Islands. Beautiful place to be. I saw that in your bio.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. I guess not that I ever plan on retiring, but if my wife could do that, yeah. Whidbey Island would be a great place to go. So.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before I bring James in, I do have bring on some of the other questions, then we'll have James in. Says, what are the definitions of harms that justify government intrusion into individuals' lives? Well, actually, I skipped the... No, I didn't. I wanted to make sure I did these north. So I'll repeat that. What are the definitions of harms that you believe that justify government intrusions into individuals' lives?
I guess I'll jump in there. I think that's...
Yeah, that was you, Peter.
We have a judicial system, and I think, as Kelly just pointed to, our Constitution really gives us all the answers. I mean, our founding fathers were brilliant. We set up a judicial system to secure our rights, and that you're innocent until proven guilty. If found guilty, for example, maybe it's a great one of the great issues is our Second Amendment rights. If you're found guilty of some crime, maybe armed robbery, then you lose your Second Amendment rights. But that's only because you were that's the punishment for the crime. So I think that it's when you commit a crime that the government is then is justified intruding upon your life. But you know, I want to kind of go back to the previous question, Robert, if I could.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, we're so concerned about snooping, Robert, but when you fill out your income tax, Robert, you forfeit your Fourth Amendment rights. You just give them away. So we're all up in arms about the snooping, which I think some of it, you know, within the national security context, if we're targeting terrorists, you know, we could. I think there's certain websites we ought to be monitoring. You know, this Tamerlan Zarnoff, that's, if I pronounce that correctly, the Boston bomber, the older brother, they knew he'd been visiting sites promoting violence, promoting attacks on the United States. So, you know, if you're monitoring those sites, you know, that'd be a good thing, right? So, but so we're all concerned about snooping, but when you sit down and do our, when I did my income tax, I told the government who I was, I told them where I lived, I told them that I had a mortgage on my house. I told them how much interest I paid on my house. I told them I had a wife. I told them I had four children, except that one just got married, and so I only had her for half the year, right, or less than half the year. I told them that I'd given some charities, the names of those charities, and I told them that my son was in college. And I'm thinking, you know, they know way too much about Pete Greenwald. But we just do that because we can get what? We get that tax deduction. We get that tax credit so we can pay our just tax under law. So, you know, instead of concerned about the snooping, I think we ought to be really fighting to abolish the 16th Amendment, and that we ought to be fighting to rid ourselves of the income tax and getting over to a fair tax where I just go, when I purchase something, I just pay a sales tax. And no one knows who I am. None of that information is given to the federal government, and yet the government gets the revenues they need. And at the same time, restore some of the powers back to our state governments, because they would collect it and they would pass it on to the federal government. So I think that, you know, it's a valid concern. It's a great question, Robert, but I think maybe we need to reflect upon how we just forfeit our liberty. We just forfeit our Fourth Amendment rights in just filling out something like our income tax unnecessarily. So just wanted to add that to the conversation, Robert.
Okay, and Kelly, go ahead and add to that, and then we'll bring in James.
Well, I like Mr. Greenwald's thoughts here on the IRS self-incrimination thing, and it's quite stunning how we do have the Fifth Amendment right to not self-incriminate, and yet the IRS, you know, they threaten you that you have to do this. Well, there is a landmark case. It's Hale versus Henkel. It's been cited by the United States Supreme Court over 150 times, states and lower courts about 1,500 times, of 1905. I mean, it is a stellar, stunning, landmark case. And this is what it says about self-incrimination and stuff. The citizen may stand upon their constitutional rights. They have no duty to open their doors to investigation, as it may tend to incriminate him. He is entitled to carry on his own business in his private manner. His power to contract is unlimited. His rights exist as the laws of the land, long antecedent to the organization of the state, and can only be taken from him by due process of law and in accordance to the Constitution. He owes no duty to the state or his neighbor, lest he trespass upon their rights. And it's like, that is so stunning. It has so many bullet points in there. But obviously your right to privacy is absolutely profound. You know, Obamacare, the census, really? No, thank you.
Census as well. I refuse to answer a number of those questions in the census in 2010. I just thought it was an intrusion upon my Fourth Amendment rights.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and we have nothing to fear by giving a bunch of information to a good government. So ends the argument of, well, I got nothing to worry about. If the government turns tyrannical, you have everything to fear if you give them that information. And it gets quite spooky. And Founders knew this.
Kellyanne, could you real quick, I was trying to take notes there. What was the name of that that case that you referenced?
Hale versus Henkel.
Hale
I think it's spelled H-E-N-K-L-E. I can look it up quick and give you the citus.
No, that's great. Hale versus Henkel, thank you.
Yeah, you can dig it up. But it's you have to dig in there a little bit, but it's in there.
Thank you.
Well, at this time, gentlemen, I'm going to go ahead and bring James in and see how he is doing. And so, James, thank you very much for calling to the show. How are you?
Oh, pretty good, Robert. Just busy, busy, busy. About to fly out to Gettysburg tomorrow.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit about that.
Well, it's Pastor Manning is busing in people from all over the East Coast to the Gettysburg battlefield, and it's called the Reconciliation of the Races rally. And there's a large number of speakers that are going to be there. I'm actually the next to last one, so I'm like the closer before. I don't remember what rank he is, and I'm terrible with names. I don't have the flyer right here in front of me. But he's a pretty high-ranking active-duty member of the Navy, and so that's got a little pressure there to close out things before he comes on and speaks, and then he's actually presenting a wreath in honor of those that died at the battle, and so that's it's going to be an amazing thing. The whole point of it is to get people to wake up to the fact that we have a large number of people in this country, a handful of them that are very, very good at it. And I say a large number, but as far as, statistically speaking, they're actually a very small number of people that just simply get rich and famous and have a level of personality or fame, rather, based on dividing people simply by the color of their skin. And the goal is to try to really revive Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream, where that's not that's not something that comes into account, that a person is judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin, and that it's really what we're trying to get started again, because the Jesse Jacksons and the Al Sharptons and the Eric Holders and the Barack Hussein Obamas have done an outstanding job of opening that wound back up, which. Up until 2008, suppose it would be 2007 when the campaign was in earnest, I honestly felt like that was well on its way towards dissipating and that wound healing. But between those four and then celebrities such as Oprah and whatnot, like that have made completely divisive statements. And, the goal is to try to start, healing that wound and just to get people to understand that, under our skin, we're the same human beings. You can take a blood transfusion from somebody and skin color has nothing to do with that. You can take an organ transplant, or a tissue transplant. Skin color has nothing to do with that. There are no different races. We're all humans. And it's time that we begin to move again in that direction. And that's really what that's about, just to try to recognize that there are those amongst us that would divide us for that superficial reason and to begin to move together, move together as the United States of America, not the divided states of hate.
Yeah, and just this is Commander Greenwald here. I just think back about my Navy experience. We wore the uniform, and it was about the mission. It was about duty. It was about supporting and defending the Constitution of the United States. And it's one thing I have great love for the Navy because we broke down the racial, to a large extent, the racial divide. Because it was all about serving our country.
Well, it's right. I grew up an Air Force brat, and you know, I hadn't seen my father for, oh my gosh, for quite some time when I was just a toddler and when he was serving in Vietnam. And we were at the airport waiting for him to get off of the plane. And the only thing I knew to look for was an olive drab uniform. And the first man that walked off of the plane that was wearing an olive drab uniform, I ran up and hugged his leg and called him Daddy. It turns out he was actually a 6'6", very large and muscular black man, you know, and that's just what it was. You know, I didn't know any better. And, you know, it wouldn't have mattered if it was or wasn't. You know, as it turns out, that wasn't my father. You know, he's a lot shorter than that. And, you know. But, you know, and that's really how people ought to look. You know, children don't know racism. You know, they don't know racism. It's something that's taught to them.
Yeah. And, well, you know, James, I just think that's a great testimony. You wrote a great story from your life and your father's return from Vietnam. That's just a great testimony. That you know, I was thinking about just from the Bible. If we get back to the Bible, get back to it sounds like this is the pastor's leading us. You know, if we just read our Bible, I just understand. You know, racism is a sin like any other sin, and I got to deal with it by going to the cross. And two, from the biblical account from Genesis, I know that we all came from Adam. Ultimately, we all came from Noah after this thing called the Great Flood. So we got this common ancestry, and because of that, I can give blood. It can be given, the blood I give can be given to anybody. So thanks.
Well, it's going to be an exciting event. You know, I'm honored to be there. I was amazed that they chose me to be one of the speakers there. I normally don't prepare anything to speak, and I just speak straight from the heart. But I was actually coming back from one of our impeach Obama protests, and you know, was kind of winding down and you know, brain calmed down, and you know. Everything that I ended up typing into my computer the next day came flooding into my head on the way home, and I just couldn't shut it up. So I knew I had to type it. You know, I had to put it into words so mm-hmm. I could repeat it, because I don't think the inspiration came from my mind. I think it was given to me, and I intend to deliver that message and with all the seriousness that it needs to be.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was wondering what your comments reminded me of I'm going to forget the verse here, but it says, you know, the love of money is the root of many evils. And I think part of this race baiting, even what we're seeing down in Mississippi, because of power and money, will drive you to many things. And I think including race baiting. And if race baiting brings in money, if it brings in power, a lot of men will fall to that temptation.
Yeah, it's interesting that some of those folks who consider themselves religious leaders, at least in my opinion, I won't mention any names, but I think we all know who we're talking about, use these types of tactics to give themselves, to line their pockets and to give them power. But I do see Dan, who has been trying to get in for quite some time, was finally able to make it in, so we want to bring him in as well. So thank you very much, Dan, for coming into the show. How are you?
Oh, frustrated. It's a good thing, though. I like challenges because I have so many of them. And I know that, Peter, you have faced some very, very difficult challenges, some difficult choices. I did miss the first 45 minutes of the show trying to get my computer working properly. Maybe it's the NSA again. We don't know. But, Peter, I want to commend you, first of all, for the courage to continue your service to this country by seeking high office, and also for the grace and willingness to back Dave Brat when you could have gone, you know, all the way to the end and ended up with Eric Cantor back in there again. That took a lot of grace, and it took a lot of well, sacrifice. But that's obviously something you're no stranger to.
Well, yeah, thanks for that, and I'll just thank the Lord and give him the praise for him working in my life and some ways making it easy.
Well, that's a good point. I also want to urge you to, and I'm pretty sure you've already made some decisions in this regard, while running for high office is one way to serve, you've already proven with your life that there are other ways, and I know that you're searching right now, if you haven't already found it, for another way. And that uniting theme is possibly the best thing of all. The example that you set, not just the words, but the example of saying, you know what, in this case, I'm going to support the other fella because he's going to do a good job and we can't have the same old stuff. Here in where Pennsylvania, where I live, we have a wonderful first-term congressman named Cartwright. He votes with Obama all the time. He's an ambulance-chasing lawyer who married the boss's daughter. And he's so progressive, it's just I think he believes this stuff, or maybe he's just in it for the power. There was a whole slate of candidates in the Republican primary. And I'm not saying the Republicans are better. I just don't like this guy. And every one of the ones in the Republican side happened to be patriotic and pretty decent, and they had some slightly different ideas on what their prime focus was and how they were going to handle it, but they met in private briefly and then came out and gave a public statement because they had to hash out whatever it was, you know, man to man. There didn't happen to be women running this time, although that would be fine too. And they agreed that whoever won the primary, the other two would get behind them 100% and campaign for them, and they're doing it. So we have a fellow named Dave Moreland, county coroner here, who is also and very pro-life, and he's running again. And I think it's going to be a fun race with a lot of money. Speaking of what I did hear James mention, go ahead.
Real quick, yeah. Speaking of James, real quick, I just got a message. He's got to actually take off soon. So I want to open up the mic to you, James. Thanks for letting me know you've got to go. So I wanted to see if you had any final comments or things you want to bring up about what you're going to be doing in the near future. And hopefully we'll be getting some shows on that as well. So go ahead, James, and we'll bring it back to you, Dan. Sorry about the interruption, but I wanted to get him in.
Not at all.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I've got to cut it short tonight, guys. I fly out tomorrow for Gettysburg, and so it's of the essence. We've got this thing going on here on the 4th, on Friday. And of course, as we did last year, not as widespread as we are this year, on the 4th and the 5th, there will be people out rallying on the 4th just with flags and whatnot like that in celebration of Independence Day. And then on the 5th, we'll go back to our typical agenda of educating the public of why Obama needs to be impeached. But then on the 18th and the 19th, Overpasses for America has actually teamed up with several groups across the country that are against illegal immigration. And the timing is really just fantastic as far as, well, you know, that event goes with this recent border surge. People are very fired up about, you know, enforcing the laws and that currently exist. We don't need immigration reform. We just need immigration enforcement. And we need to protect our border. We talk about, you know, you mentioned earlier about Islamofascists, but, our real clear and present danger is our southern border that's wide open. And it needs to be defended because, well, let's face it, if we have illegal aliens from Central and South America and Mexico coming in, we most certainly stand a risk of terrorists coming in through that very same border. And, you know, it's in a vested interest to protect the United States by monitoring that border to ensure people that aren't citizens or legal immigrants come through here. And this is something that's going to be happening coast to coast. And, you know, we want to put some pressure on Congress to get something done with that, just to simply enforce the current laws. We don't need any reform. That's already been done. It just has never been enforced. And unfortunately, it hasn't been done since Ronald Reagan was in office. George H.W. Bush didn't do it. Clinton didn't do it. George Bush didn't do it. And my gosh, you know, President Obama has just put up a great big neon welcome sign, and it's just kicked it into overdrive. And just current enforcement of the law. And, you know, with that said, something that I've been kind of beating a drum about is two things we mentioned earlier was DHS and the NSA. If the NSA is capable of listening to every communication within the United States, then they most certainly can track down every illegal alien in the United States. We should put those resources to use and remove anybody that's here illegally from within the borders of the United States and return them to their native nation. I'm not talking about doing it cruelly, but just follow the rule of law. And another thing that we should do as far as enforcing the rule of law is there are penalties, financial penalties and possibly criminal penalties for hiring people that are not legally in the United States. And if we were to simply enforce those laws, I believe that we wouldn't have people coming north across the border. They would be going back south across the border because nobody would dare hire them. And, you know, we have to protect America first. Do we need to streamline our immigration? I believe so. Do we need to just completely forget we have any laws? Well, no, we're a nation of laws, and we should enforce the laws that are on the books. They haven't been done for a very long time, and now we find ourselves in a situation where some estimates put us up to, 30 million people living in this country that don't belong here. And, I feel for them. Where they live can't be very good or they wouldn't be leaving. But just like our founding fathers lived in a nation where things were not so great, enough to the point to where they protested and then they eventually took to arms, I really think that if where you live is that oppressive, then perhaps you need to follow the example of our founding fathers and create a government that allows you to have freedoms. Don't flee.
Exactly.
Our founding fathers didn't flee. You know, they took care of the problem that was
very
at hand.
Very good point.
And at any rate, that's a big thing. Paul, we have a guest for you if we have time to talk about that. If you don't have your next couple of weeks already scheduled out,
let me look. I know since you brought it up, next week we are slotted to have former Congressman Traficant on. And then after that, we have Robert Sarvis. He's going to be on the 16th. And then I believe we may have the 23rd, but we may have Steve Strange in on the 23rd, still trying to nail that one down. So we may still have the 23rd or the 30th open if we're still looking at July.
Okay, well, we're actually going to be doing this nationwide thing on July 18th and 19th, but perhaps I could get him on there and we could give you a post-event, post-protest update.
Well, what we could also do, I may be out of town, but I'd still be able to do a show while out of town. I know I still have the regular show the week of the 13th, but I'll still be doing the Wednesday show, but perhaps, and we've talked about this a little bit off the air, we'll talk more about it. Perhaps we can get a show going where there's, don't have to be the full 3 hours, but maybe we could do a show where there's a reporting from that event. I think that'd be pretty great.
Yeah, that sounds great. Just give me a call and we'll get that set up.
All right, sounds good. It'll either be the Friday or the Saturday. I'll have to see what my going out of town plans are. I'm not sure what we're going to do yet, but I'll keep you posted and we'll work something out.
Okay, sounds great, and thanks again for having me. But, yeah, I really do need to go. I have to get up early
and get everything
ready.
All right,
James,
thank you very much. James, you take care and have a great trip.
Thanks.
Yeah, and all the best in Gettysburg.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that was our panelist, James Nabors, of course, the founder of Overpasses for America. So definitely check that out on Facebook. Just put a in the search engine, just put Overpasses for America and check out their page. So we did kind of cut you off a little bit there, Dan. The freak did have his final comment, so I want to bring it back to you. Go ahead.
Well, no, it's quite all right. James is always interesting to listen to. As he says, he speaks from the heart and has a great deal of knowledge as well, which is and just a great guy. I was lucky enough to meet him in Washington last month, and I can't say enough good things about him. But to get back to the topic, which James and Peter were discussing, race is not the only divider. Gettysburg is a great thing to remind us that we want to reconcile the races, but they divide us every possible way they can. And the whole reason is because by doing that, they dilute our power. I have plenty in common with black people, Mexican people. I really don't care where they come from if they come here legally. Matter of fact, I've got a very short story and a couple other points. But when I was a little boy, about 5 years old, we were playing, and our block had like 400 kids. It was baby boom time. And we heard a bad word. You know what happens when little boys hear bad words? We went crazy with this bad word, and we were called a mixed crowd. I grew up in Bill Cosby's neighborhood. We're about half black and half white on my block. And we were calling each other this name. And then we all went home, and, of course, we were daring enough to try it in front of our parents and see what happened. And that was the first time we realized what the word nigger meant. And I'm going to say it because it's a word that has a lot of controversy, and I'm not saying it in any sort of bad way. I'm not accusing anyone of anything. And the next day we showed up on the playground, and we're looking at each other, and we didn't know what to say to each other. Like, really? Because all our parents had told us some of the backstory. We were unaware of that. Our society had gotten to a point where our parents felt comfortable with us playing together, going to school together. My best friend, the first best friend that I lost over the many years, I'm 53 now, I think we were 11 or 12 when he died of sickle cell anemia. So there is plenty of reasons to divide, and it's all about power. Since James was suggesting a possible future guest, I'd like to suggest Reverend Stevie Fielder, First Union Missionary Baptist Church in Meridian, Mississippi. He is the black pastor, who's a Democrat, who has come clean. He's telling the truth and said that Cochran's campaign in Mississippi actually paid him to get his congregation to vote against McDaniel. And we don't know if we've seen the end of that race yet. To just briefly touch on the immigration thing before I use up all I'm trying to make up for lost time here tonight. The 17th and 18th of this month, Bob, I urge you to have a special show if you can. Friday the 18th would be great because we'll have some results to show. There are literally hundreds of groups, some of which I'm involved with and some of which I've never heard of, and it pops up on Facebook or Twitter, and I go, let me check these people out. Another group of people who are uniting. Tonight I spent with local politics at my township supervisors meeting, and instead of a five-minute meeting with three or four people, we're up to 45, 50 people showing up. And even though it's small potatoes in a local race, a local area, it's the same exact thing as you see in the state capitals and in Washington. In fact, there's a local component to all of this stuff, folks. It's not just the fact that Obama's encouraging illegals to cross the border, that 80% of our Border Patrol is now involved in babysitting duties, that a lot of these children who come in are 17-year-old MS-13 narco-terroristic gang members who are, you know, stone killers, some of them. It's also the fact that there's no medical quarantine going on. When my folks came through Ellis Island, if you were too sick, and they'd treat you. It wasn't that they would just, like, send you back or leave you to die. They gave you medical treatment. But they wouldn't let you go into the population with a communicable disease until you were better, because it was just bad for public policy, bad for everyone who's already here. Well, they're not doing that. And there have been news reports coming out.
Smallpox is making a resurgence, from my understanding.
got kids coming through and God knows who with dengue fever and, you know, scabies and all kinds of communicable diseases. Not only is there no quarantine, but they're sending these people, these mostly children, they are children, on common carriers like buses and airplanes without any warning, without any knowledge that you have to clean up afterwards. One of the congressmen in the next district over, Lou Barletta, he's from just about 20 miles north of here in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. You may recall this fellow as the guy who tried to stop illegal immigration in his own city. Well, he's down on the border now, and one of his big concerns is that the federal government wants to open up a refuge shelter. I don't know if it's going to be a camp or a high-rise. I don't know what it is, but in Hazleton, this is 18 miles from my house. I did the math thing where they want to open this up. And I'm not against children, but sending children unescorted across the border with medical issues to be cared for by no one just because you want to break the system, this is classic Cloward and Piven. It did, as James said, with Obama. Reagan was guilty too. He allowed the other side to bamboozle him into the first amnesty, which was a terrible idea. And it started even earlier in 1967 with Ted Kennedy's Immigration Reform Act, which basically took it from the realm of we want educated people, we want people who are good moral character, we want people who are going to be, an asset to society, to give us the poorest, give us the least educated, give us the people who are definitely not likely to succeed so that we can get them on welfare. And not to say that a lot of them aren't hardworking people, but it's disproportionate because it's very hard to make it in America, at least it was back then, if you had absolutely nothing going for you. And it used to be they'd allow a certain percentage of people like that to come in, especially if they had true refugee status. But it changed from that to just open up the floodgates, and in the meantime, let's limit the number of people who come from countries with good education systems, with good informational systems, so that we can actually vet these people before we let them in. I am absolutely in favor of sanctioning employers and having them use the very same system that we use at the unemployment office where I work. It's called the SAVE system, S-A-V-E, which is an authorization and verification for employment. We get a number. We can plug it in right away, and if it doesn't match, will we ask them if they want to qualify for benefits, if they've been working, to send in a copy, a clear copy, of their actual card. And the actual card has been scanned into the system. So when they send their copy, we can actually not only compare numbers, which are easy to fool, but we can compare what they sent us with the picture of the person who's real, and they have to appear the same or else they have to appear in person. And that's just, they don't even bother trying to do fraud. The last president who actually treated this properly was Dwight David Eisenhower, when there was a huge influx of poor, hardworking Mexican people who just overwhelmed the system. He authorized the National Guard to just round them up, send them back, and there was no camps. I do not want to see the NSA picking out people and sending them back. I know people who are here legally who have accents, and I know that I don't trust the NSA or any administration to not pick on people who they just want to get rid of. And also, I work for government. Come on. They make too many mistakes. The simple solution is to truly reform the law, but not the way the progressives want, and not until there is a fence. My final thought on that particular issue before I stop monopolizing the mic is a comment that was made by, Charles Krauthammer today. The guy is really good with a pithy phrase that just evokes everything. He said, well, if fences don't work, why is there one around the White House? And with that, back to you.
That was really good.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Peter. let's bring it back on.
Yeah, speaking of liberty, I saw some other, I don't know who it was, a quote today that, well, if women use clothes as contraception, do we now have to buy them a wardrobe?
that's another good pithy comment.
I thought that was a good one today. Speaking of liberty and personal responsibility, so yeah.
I wonder if Sandra Fluke has an entire closet full of shoes.
and let's talk about that for a little bit. Not the shoes, but about the Supreme Court's ruling over the Hobby Lobby case. What do you think about that, Peter?
Well, you know, of course, I'm happy for that. But you know, ultimately, getting back to personal responsibility and liberty, the real victory will be when we completely overturn Obamacare, which you know, four of the Supreme Court justices said unconstitutional. So, you know, although I'm glad for it, I know that's just yeah, it's one small victory. I'm glad that there's some respect for our religious freedom, our First Amendment rights, for the owners of Hobby Lobby and others. But again, the real answer will be the complete repeal of Obamacare.
You know, that's a good point. Hobby Lobby, and that included another firm called Conestoga Wood Products, which is about 60-70 miles from here. It's a very narrow ruling in its scope, just like the Miller case for SEIU was very, very narrow. It said specifically in Hobby Lobby that the private employers are able to have a religious exemption that is comparable to what bona fide, recognized, and acknowledged religious organizations have. The problem with that is the Catholic Church and other groups, other churches, are having a real hard time, and they're still in court. It hasn't even reached the Supreme Court as to exactly what their exemptions are on a matter of conscience. They have nuns who have. I'm not a Catholic, but these are women who have devoted their entire life to being brides for Christ. There have not been any scandals involving nuns abusing anyone, just a few, you know, priests who were covered, where it was covered up. These are people who are in service to others, primarily nuns. It's kind of like doctors and nurses. Doctors, yeah, you have problems with ego. Nurses, they're the ones who are actually doing the majority of the healing. They're there to comfort and to service, and like Mother Teresa washing the feet of lepers, going into war zones to educate people and feed people without any distinction as to who you are. That's who these nuns are, and they're being forced to pay for abortifacients, for drugs that cause the baby to not implant or to be spontaneously aborted. This is horrible. I will say, though, even though that was a 5-4 ruling, as Peter mentioned, they did hand down another ruling. There's quite a few good ones for a change. And that ruling dealt with the so-called recess appointments, where the president decided that even though the Constitution specifically said Congress decides when it's in session, he said, no, they're not in session, and I'm just going to appoint my cronies to the National Labor Relations Board. And 2 years of bad decisions by these it's a word I won't say on your show, Bob, but that was a unanimous Supreme Court decision to knock that down, to say you can't do that. And this is the 20th unanimous court decision, which includes Ginsburg, which includes you know, Kennedy, who is a swing vote, and it even includes the two that Obama himself,
Sotomayor, and who was the other one?
Kagan.
Kagan.
Even they can't stomach somebody who is going to just simply take it upon themselves. I'm really, really concerned that this megalomaniac in the White House may decide to do something that we may not have a constitutional recourse. He could declare, if he declared the courts to be null and void, for instance, which there's no information that's happening, folks. This is not a conspiracy theory or a news report. This is a speculation. But if he did that, there'd be no court to knock him back a peg. So, I mean, and he immediately, following getting slapped down, taunted Congress and the courts and said, I don't care. I'm going to just do what I want to do.
Right. Okay, he thinks he's a king. Go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to throw out some thoughts about Supreme Courts. And, yes, Supreme Court has had some really good rulings lately. I have sent this probably going back to, oh gosh, before, still in the 90s, late 90s. We came to the conclusion that, you know, without the Supreme Court, our country would have been done a long time ago. They have stalled a lot of bad agendas. They have ruled on liberty. They get it right an awful lot of times, and it's pretty exciting, you know, Hobby Lobby, but I'll get there quick. They also required a warrant for a phone.
Yes.
That came out of California,
mm-hmm, right,
where I live, you know, again, Pima Region 9. But, yeah, you just can't grab somebody's phone and go through it. There you go again, the Fourth Amendment. You go get a warrant. I know it's a little bit more work, but, you know, go get the warrant. You know, you got 10 suspects, you're holding onto their phone, put them all into one document in front of the judge. They'll just say yes, 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 no, yes, yes, no. I mean, really, I mean, it's just, it's so frustrating. But anyway, so that was a good one. Striking a boo-boo down with his appointments, that was great. I'm beginning to wonder if the Supreme Court's just not liking him. Oh, and by the way, striking down Obama's appointments, that was unanimous.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. We got some, yes, liberals do care about
wow.
the Constitution. So that's a stunning point. Hobby Lobby, finally. But I find this all so ironic where the those of choice, you know, we want our contraceptive paid, choice. Well, are you respecting the choice of those you're forcing to pay for those condiments?
Right.
I mean, condominiums, I mean, the anyway, you know what I'm saying? And we shouldn't be forced to pay for condiments. I mean, if I want condiments on my hamburger, then I should pay for it.
That's disgusting, Kelly.
What, hamburgers? Oh, I had one today. They're yummy.
Well.
Anyway.
It's not Bard's Logic After Dark yet, gentlemen. No.
Oh, okay.
Let's go ahead, gentlemen, and let's bring Peter back in here for his thoughts on that.
I'm not sure I could add anything more to that, Robert, after that last one.
Well, okay. Well, we've got a question here that is pertinent to our discussion for this evening, and let's talk about what are the clear limits to individual liberty. Do limits exist prior to a person's activities which are bumping up against another's?
Yeah, I just thought that another good way of putting that, Robert, was that, you know, my rights end where another person's rights begin. And so I think that's, you know, as I was getting ready for tonight, I was thinking about John Adams. And, you know, he wrote in a letter, I guess, to the officer of the 1st Brigade of the 3rd Division of the Militia of Massachusetts in 1798. He wrote that our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. And I think John Adams had a lot of wisdom there, that he understood that through my moral and religious training, I think someone else said they grew up Catholic or not, you know, I grew up Catholic and learned about God and Ten Commandments and, you know, about loving God and loving others. And I think with in that training and that, you know, I learned to respect others. And you know, just right through the Ten Commandments, you know, thou shalt not steal. And I think in that, you come to understand there's personal property and that you respect others' personal property rights. And I think what we've done, and I think this is, you know, we talked about President Obama. What's more important is these are Marxists. They deny God-given rights, and in turn they deny God. And I think over the last in my lifetime, they pushed God out of our schools, and it took the Ten Commandments off the walls. And what that's left us with is several generations that don't know God, don't understand God's laws, that God created all of us. And that we're endowed with certain animal rights, and that we need to respect those. That's kind of where I left. I think we need to get back to our founding fathers and the wisdom of our founding fathers, including John Adams, and then we'll have a right understanding of our own personal liberty.
You know, when you talk about future crimes, using some sort of predictor of what somebody might do in order to stop them, it has to be imminent harm. In other words, I can't say, that fellow's looking at me funny, and I thought, you know, he just might do something, and I imagined the whole scenario of events in my head that weren't actually happening, so I went and shot him. But if that fellow is running at you, screaming, who is brandishing a weapon, then if you were to do something, whether you were a government person, acting under the color of authority, or whether you were just a private person, you'd have a legitimate argument to make that you were in a reasonable fear that something bad would happen if you didn't act immediately. But too often, they're using pretexts to get into our lives. You talked about property rights. Zoning itself, which is only about 100 years old, is a way of curtailing people's property rights. Not saying, okay, you've got a junkyard and it's dangerous right now, so please put up a fence so that we don't have problems. Or you can't have a slaughterhouse with that smell and that stench or a chemical factory right next to where 10,000 people are living and have their little children, because that's an imminent danger. You're saying these laws can apply. Well, you can't put a shed there, which is no danger. You must pay us a large amount of money in property taxes. I own my home outright, but I really don't, because if I don't pay my property taxes, they seize my home.
Yes.
So I have a series of questions that Bob had asked me to put together, and it's off the top of my head. In today's information age, and I'll answer briefly what I think, these are just topics of discussion, how far is too far for government security apparatus? What would be effective substitutes for widespread snooping? And I think the answer to that is real simple. You can't predict or prevent everything. The main thing is to look at true dangers. And police officers and federal officers, they're tasked with only one thing, really, which is the detection of crime, the gathering of information, and the preparation of that information for a district attorney or a grand jury to decide if there's evidence to indict. And then we ask, well, what are definitions of harms that justify government intrusions into individuals' lives? They swooped in with SWAT teams into a guitar factory because these people might have been using some rare woods. I don't see any imminent harm. They go after farms that produce raw milk for people who choose to buy raw milk. I prefer half and half in my coffee personally, and that's fine. But there was no imminent harm there, and nobody had actually gotten sick. And had someone gotten sick from some sort of bacterial infection, it would have been more of a health matter, and they could have shut them down and made them clean it up.
So, Mr. Gray, you like condiments in your coffee.
The answer to cream in your coffee is not recently. But
all right, so should somebody else have to pay for your condiments in your coffee?
Well, you know, there is no limitation of choice because you're not buying me a thing that I want doesn't mean I don't have the freedom to go and buy it. There are expensive forms of birth control, but there are also extremely effective, inexpensive ones, and, of course, the cheapest one is abstinence. Kelly, I have other questions, but there's just one here. This is a constitutional question that I'd like you and Peter and Bob to look at. The interpretation of the welfare state is based on the general welfare clause. Does the government really have any business under that general welfare clause to promote and or to curtail individual activities on the often wrong premise that it actually helps society progress? Is that the government's role constitutionally?
Yeah, I was going to say my quick answer is no, and that we need to place the general welfare clause under the context of the entire Constitution. And when you do that, That clearly is noted. You know, that we set up the there in the preamble the role of the purpose of our government, but not actually the powers. Here's the purpose, but not the actual powers. To get to the powers, we need to look at Article 1, Section 8 and go from there. And of course, we got to look to our Bill of Rights to see, including the Tenth Amendment. So, well, you know, unless it's specifically delegated, then those powers remain with the state and then, of course, to the people. So in the context, clearly not. There is no the answer is just a no, that it's a wrong premise to promote the government to promote progress. So,
it's a complicated in the sense, I'll decipher this out on both sides, okay? I'm going to use some history, some common sense, and what I understand of the Constitution. It does say the general welfare. There is also eminent domain in the Constitution, which means what? Well, if there's a huge bridge to go across, say, or a river, say the Susquehanna there, state to state, which state pays for it? Well, you know, they could go ahead and both states work out an agreement and they're good to go, but they still would have to use eminent domain for a road to, you know, move some people. And, you know, eminent domain was heavily involved when the interstate system came in, thanks mm-hmm. to Ike. And there's another congressman who came out of my area. I can't remember his name right now. So eminent domain is a sense of doing for the public what they can't do as individuals. All right. The Navy, in one sense, is a general welfare because, you know, you and I can't afford a Navy, but together we can. So if you look at that sense of general welfare combined with the reality that the federal government was never intended to be the sponsor it is now, the states would handle so much of their own problems, who cares? But the general welfare had a legitimate – every word the founders put in the Constitution, I mean, they spent, what, May – 87 until about September 15th or 17th, they put a long time. Every word means something and was precisely chosen. So when they put general welfare, that's kind of my take, is when even a state can't provide for itself, the federal government comes together, you know, again, the Navy, et cetera. But when the states want to have their own welfare system and this goodie for that person who sits on his butt all day and state unemployment, whatever, that's fine for the state. I don't think the founders ever intended this welfare system to be in based on the general welfare. Of course, there's the Commerce Clause, too, which is another frustrating thing that overreaches the powers of the federal government. So when you decipher it out into the history of general welfare, when people can't do for themselves, we band together, great, but not in the individual welfare that they have perverted it into. I just don't see any basis for it. There was not a strict, you shall not do personal welfare for somebody having to give in Mississippi to somebody who they don't know in Minnesota because they lost their job or blah, blah, blah reason. There was never any proponent, but there wasn't a precise limitation, no way, no how, not in this lifetime, in the Constitution, but it has been perverted from the original meaning of the history and the times.
Well, yeah, I think the Navy is a great example because we provide for a Navy in Article 1.
Mm-hmm.
There it is. It says the federal government, we the people, gave the federal government the power to establish a Navy. In turn, by defining that, we said that will provide in part for the general welfare. But again, it was defined, it was enumerated. So we the people gave the power to the federal government to do that. We did not anywhere, as I said, one section, do we anywhere give the federal government the power, for example, to be involved with education. Now, you can make a strong argument that education provides for the general welfare, but nowhere in the Constitution you say that we'll establish a Department of Education or that the federal government be involved with education. That should remain at the, well, in my case, here at the county level. And as we moved away from that and farther away from that, We got now a common core. So I think that, again, if we go back to our Constitution, and I forget that was Dan or James I mentioned, you know, it provides, the wisdom of our founding fathers, it provides many of the answers to the problems we have today.
You know, it's interesting, Peter, because you're biblically based, and there are some things that are extremely clear, and yet they can, the logic can be tortured. The Commerce Clause, of which Kelly just mentioned, was tortured in a case during World War II where a farmer decided to grow wheat on his farm for his own livestock, for his own family to eat, period. It never left the farm. There was absolutely,
yeah.
And he was accused of violating wage and price laws and agricultural law. They had a bunch of laws in place for the war effort, which
yeah.
never seemed to go away. They just mutate and grow larger. But they tortured the logic to say that because he was doing this, he wasn't purchasing it from someone else, which was somehow, I don't even see how they got there, somehow related to the Interstate Commerce Clause that he was violating because he wasn't having something transported by train across a state line. These are situational ethics. Now, people get confused. They think there are gray areas about what's right and wrong. I don't think there are gray areas at all. I think everything is clearly black and white. The only question is how much do you know about a situation? I've used this analogy before. If all I told you was that I drove to a neighborhood that I had no particular business in and went to a mansion, kicked down the door, a woman screamed, I hit her, knocked her out, rolled her up in a $30,000 oriental carpet and dragged her out of the house, I could be guilty of all kinds of felonies. On the other hand, if a detour led me down this road, I saw smoke billowing out the window, I called 911 and heard a scream, she was hysterical and on fire, and I knocked her out to be able to move her and wrapped her up in the carpet to keep her from burning, then there's no question of right or wrong. So at what point does an individual, this leads into the idea of saving lives, because the biggest issue of my heart is abortion, because we're actually committing a Holocaust. We're murdering millions of innocent civilians for no reason every year. And at what point
right.
does an individual become bestowed with these inalienable rights that our founders talked about? Can these rights ever be taken away legitimately? And the answer, in my view, is possibly, provided we go through all avenues of due process, where there's an actual crime, an actual trial, an actual court hearing, et cetera. But do these rights actually end at some point? What if a person is too old or too sick or too mentally disabled to contribute to the village, to the common good, to the communist ideal? This person isn't contributing to society in the way that our betters would want to see. Is it okay to deprive them of care, as they've deprived so many veterans through the VA, as they're now starting under Obamacare, that the numbers are starting to mount up of, in fact, one of the a woman who had been suing to try and get her medicine just died while waiting. I mean, is there an end to this?
Well, let me throw out some. Well, we should get. All right, I'm so excited about what my congressman did. I'm like, I got to jump in. This is so awesome. The field rep came up to one of our tea parties. We got three of them here in a county of 45,000 people. We're larger than the state of Delaware or Rhode Island, and we are very proud of our nice new stoplight. But that's another joke. All right. But they still
we just got rid of a stop sign.
Okay. Oh, wow. Anyway, so Erin Ryan came up. She's the field office, comes out of Reading, which is about 2 hours south of it. And about this issue of depriving people, well, there is a contract. Under the laws of contracts, sorry, somebody is bailing. Somebody needs to go to jail, and that's what Erin Ryan said. She came up. She's a field manager for Doug LaMalfa. She told this awesome victory story. Went afterwards, you know, she sat down. I just came up there and shook her hand. I was about in tears. But she was talking that 14,000 veterans is what this service center deals with, and the paperwork and who gets help next, whatever. And she said about a third of them have died.
Oh.
And I raised my hand quick. Is that just the Oakland paperwork division, or is that all the others? And she said, no, that's just Oakland. And I'm like, what? And so the whistleblowers had had enough. They came forward. Doug LaMalfa showed up unannounced, and there's a security protocol and all this kind of stuff to get in. The whistleblowers were at the back door. Yeah, come on in. And they caught him on this floor, that floor, that floor. And Oakland is what? Right next to San Francisco, you know, liberal capital of the West Coast. And so he's going around, and a lot of the top administrators, I'll say it this way. They needed a fresh change of underwear.
And they can send their old underwear to the Border Patrol.
Well, there you go. So what happened was
he
was
just take care of all those folks.
Yeah, they were the person they've been trying to help for 15 years. I'm not in tears just hearing this. About 15 years, and they finally got to the top of the list. And what was going on in this stupid Oakland? They have complete contempt for the military. They have complete contempt for congressmen. Here's what's going on. If they save the VA money, they can promote promotion, a raise, and a bonus. So you're going to save people's lives? Are you going to save the government money and get your own stinking bonus so at the expense of veterans dying? Are these people out of their freaking mind? All right, I'm going a little bit off here. But they appointed a new person. By the way, one of the whistleblowers got put into a top position temporarily. And then they had this one lady who was a really good bulldog, a great professionally minded. She came from, I think it was Seattle or Portland. And she said, all right, everybody, we're having a meeting now. Everybody. I've heard about the congressman's report, and that's why I'm here, and that's why I'm in the head right now. And, that son of a beep, beep, swear. He is a United States congressman, and you will respect that position, and you will call him that. Anybody who does not call him that will have a 30-day paid leave, or unpaid leave. Unpaid, you're up to 30 days unpaid. Is that clear? And one guy got up and said, F you. Oh, we have a volunteer. You are done for 30 days without pay. And so they're getting things straightened out, at least in Oakland. Aaron's conclusion was there are people going to go to jail over this.
I'm thinking with the real, as I've been thinking through this, I think, you know, liberty's the answer. It seems it always is, right? Give greater freedom back to your veterans. I think maybe let's get completely rid of this whole VA bureaucracy and give the power back to the veterans to go to their local doctor. Now, I've got that.
Yes.
I've got that. I don't go to my – there's a local VA here, McGuire Medical Center. I don't go there. I have TRICARE. It's a great – I pay into that thanks to my the support of my fellow taxpayers. I've got a great TRICARE benefit. I'm just wondering what Obamacare is going to do to that. I'm not sure yet, but – well, my premiums went up 20%, but that didn't hit me nearly as hard as some other who had much higher premiums to begin with. But why don't we get the veterans out there, to the local doctor? You know, give them the money or whatever it takes to exercise freedom in choosing the doctor, not be forced to go to the VA. I think that would be part of the answer here.
I have a friend, a good friend here in town, and he's a Beirut Marine. And combat disabled, had a lot of health issues, just a couple years older than me, and is a really good guy. And
yep.
John is his name. I don't say last names unless if he says it's okay, and he probably will when I see him. He's pretty open. He tells me stories about what's been going on with the VA, and he's been working with Harriet on this issue, Harriet Brinker, who is one of our regular panelists on the show, who's very, very concerned as a nurse with the situation with veterans. And some of the things that they've done to him, he had a heart situation, a cardiac situation, and they said, oh, you're not on a blood pressure medication. He says, I have low blood pressure. They prescribed this stuff to him, nearly killed him. He's had numerous issues with broken feet from a shipboard accident. He was a Marine, so you know they pretty much serve everywhere. You name it, wherever there's need for somebody to step in the way of trouble, that's where we send our Marines, first ones in, not to denigrate any other service at all. But that's their role, and they volunteer for this. And the litany of stupidity and a venal behavior and corrupt behavior. And he trusted them and cannot afford to go and get his own private medical care. And he's actually had to learn and you know, teach himself. He's not a doctor any more than I am. But, you know, when you get sick, you learn everything you can about your own medical condition. And he's using the best that he can afford of over-the-counter stuff and, you know, herbs and whatever will help. It's not a cure for any of these things, but he's doing far better than he was under the VA, and I don't think he's doing as well as he would had he a private physician who actually knew what they were doing, who wasn't being paid as they're starting to do under Obamacare based on how fast you see a patient and how cheap you treat them, but based on what's best for the patient. There are people who come in who you can treat in an inexpensive fashion. I myself am blessed with some pretty good health. Even though I've got some chronic issues, I don't have anything that requires me to see physicians. I don't take any prescription medications of any kind. But I know plenty of people who do. And if the money they're saving on me, they can spend on them. I have no problem with that. But that's not the motivation. They seek that there's some sort of a common good out there. Let me just wrap this up real quick. That instead of... instead of inspiring people like doctors, like the rest of us, to simply step up and do our duty and do our best in our private lives to assist, to help through voluntary associations, through organizations, through churches, et cetera, no, they seem to think that they can legislate this against people's will to their alleged common good, with them as the middleman taking a cut, coming and going, and ending up just despising the very people that they are allegedly serving.
Well, in medicine, I mean, your point is well taken.
I want to go ahead and finish it off real quick, and I do want to bring Cindy in. We haven't heard from Cindy for a while. She's been out of town, so it'd be great to have her here on the show. So if you want to finish that comment, then
quick.
I do want to bring Cindy in. I'm sorry?
Mine will be quick.
Okay, and then also I noticed we've only got less than 12 minutes left of the live portion, so we will be going to extended version of the show or portion of the show. So for those who'd like to listen in or chime in to the extended part of the show, just give us a call at 347-945-7428. But if you cannot make it because it's late there, you're always welcome to listen to the archive later on the show, and of course share the link out with folks on Facebook, Twitter, and email as well, so that they can hear the content of the show as well and share it with others. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Kelly.
Well, yeah, real quickly, in overtime, I'm going to read segments of the Declaration of Independence. They actually proved it on July 2nd, you know, today, and we have the 4th coming up. All right, about the... I just got this amazing web something, and it's, we all know about the Hippocratic Oath that goes back to, I believe, the Greeks, that as a physician you must do what is in the best interest of your patient. Well, what's really going on is some doctors and the VA employees, they have taken a different oath. It's called the, instead of the Hippocratic Oath, it's called the Hypothetical Oath.
Or hypocritical.
Or hypocritical?
Yeah, I've heard of
it being
that. I've heard of that one, hypocritical oath.
Yeah.
Well, this time I do want to bring Cindy in, so I'll be opening up your mic. Thank you very much, Cindy, for calling to the show. It's great to hear from you. How are you?
Hi, Cindy.
Well, hi. How's everybody doing?
Yeah, doing great.
Very good. How are you? Happy pre-4th of July.
You.
Well, I have to leave early tonight, so I wanted to hurry up and get in my question before I had to go. First of all, I want to thank Peter for coming on. Really appreciate you being here, and appreciate that you stepped up and decided to serve your community because you saw how things were going, and I'm hoping there's a lot more like you out there that are skilled and know what's going on in the Constitution.
Right, you're welcome, Cindy. You're welcome.
I want to ask this of both you and Kelly, Mr. Greenwald. And Kelly, I'm going to ask it to you like this. Can we not somehow use the fourth branch to get rid of Obama? Or, Mr. Greenwald, in your case, do you have any ideas about how the government can, I mean, how Congress can shut down Obama's pen and his phone? And will you be proactive and work to terminate his imperial administration? Do you have any good ideas how to get him, how to stop him?
Yeah, I think it takes
like he's totally without law.
Yeah, I think that's and why I stepped in the race back in October. I saw failed leadership on the part of the Speaker of the House and, of course, you know, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, because they weren't exercising good leadership. They weren't providing, you know, James Madison. I was just reading Federalist 51 with my daughters this evening, and you know, they aren't exercising that check and balance that our founding fathers intended. They aren't doing that. So,
we have to take the Senate.
We need to do that, but even within the House, they had the power. For example, they could have not funded Obamacare. That would have been a hard thing to do. That would have taken some courage. That would have meant you had been completely, you know, torn apart by the media. Got that. But you got to do the hard thing. If you're going to look out for the people, if you're going to secure the blessings of liberty to yourselves and our posterity, you do the hard thing and provide that check and balance, and you don't negotiate with the Marxist. I mean, you don't do that. Maybe you don't recognize who you're dealing with, but you're there. You're dealing with someone who seeks to, I think, destroy America, that seeks to destroy our constitutional republic, and you understand that threat, and you answer it with maybe people seeing some extreme measures, but that's what you do, and so I think, of course, the Constitution provides for impeachment. I think there's grounds for impeachment here. I think about Benghazi, and, you know, you I'm just not sure why they haven't brought articles of impeachment. I'm hoping maybe we get a new Speaker of the House. Maybe that's somebody like Trey Gowdy. Maybe that's somebody that has the courage to take those steps. And people say, well, we're not going to do it because nothing's going to happen to the Senate. Well, I think you do what you can. As I always say, the duty is ours, and the results belong to God.
Well, Congress is basically structured to favor cronyism and seniority, and it's, you know, you're going to be a freshman congressman coming in. So I'm wondering, what do you see as your role in that? How can you be proactive in your situation? I mean, I see some, like our congressman, Ron DeSantis, has gone in there and really all of a sudden he's got a high profile. People are listening to him. He's getting on TV talk shows. I mean, he's really been doing a good job of trying to get the word out and doing what he can. But there is only so much you can do because of how Congress is, the rules of Congress are structured. What do you see as your personal role when you
get Cindy, yeah, you know, I think back on March 27th, and I don't know if you got the word, you know, I did bow to the race and endorsed Dr. Brad. Of course, he went on to defeat Eric Cantor on June 10th. But you know, I continue to work here. I think one of the things I plan on working on is I really like this idea of the Convention of the States as provided in Article 5. That's an effort that I want to support providing for, I think what Mark Levin would call liberty amendments. You know, I think get rid of the 16th Amendment, establish some term limits. It'll go a long way towards that.
Well, can I just tell you that if I can give you my opinion, I think the Convention of the States is a very dangerous thing for us to do because right now progressives are in control of our government, and I think it's progressives that would run the convention, and I think progressives could actually do more damage to our Bill of Rights than what they've already done now.
Well, I think if it's like our...
Yeah, there's a lot of folks out there that have that concern, Cindy. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, I do. I think that we're living in... I think our constitutional republic, in a way, is already gone.
And I think it requires some extreme measures, and I think those are provided for, as I read Article 5. I think if I look across the states, you know, right here in Virginia, yeah, we have a U.S. two Democratic U.S. senators. We have a Democratic governor. But, you know, in our House, in the delegates, is controlled by Republicans. The Senate is now controlled by Republicans. I think you might find that that may not be true. It's not controlled by progressives. As I look across many of the state houses, the legislatures across our states, many of those are controlled by conservatives.
I just wonder about it because I hear that people like George Soros are funding the movement to get a convention of the states, and that just scares me knowing that someone on the other side is confident enough in the outcome that they would put, you know, millions of dollars into it. So I really think we ought to think hard on it before we actually accept that.
Cindy, let me throw something out about the Article 5 Convention. There are people there who dearly love the Constitution. They call it defendnotamend.com or .org, I can't remember. But here's something frightening. So we conquered Iraq. Here's your Constitution that we would like you to adopt. Let's see. Oh, you don't have the right to own guns. You don't have trial by jury. Health care is a right. Wait a minute. Who gave them this? Who was the commander in charge? Oh, that's right, George W. Bush gave them this Constitution. What kind of, you know, if Dwight D. Eisenhower gave them a model Constitution, what would it have been? You know, Thomas Jefferson, what kind of Constitution would it have been? We gave them this no right to trial by jury. You can't own guns, and health care is a right. Are you out of your freaking mind? That's what scares me about the Article 5, is who's in control. So, anyway, I wanted to answer some of your questions about getting a boo-boo out of office, okay? You mentioned the fourth branch. And Peter, I authored a book called The Hidden Fourth Branch. It's about the power of the grand jury. Started at Runnymede, England, where the Magna Carta was above the king, and the grand jury would enforce the Magna Carta. There was no elected parliament, 1215 A.D. Anyway, it helped that country, by the way, last about 900 years, so there's something about it. And our Supreme Court has affirmed this power independent. It's not controlled by the judicial or the legislature or the prosecutor. It is absolutely independent. In the United States Attorney Manual, it is independent, period. You must treat the grand jury as independent. If we look at the model, if you will, and I'm going to talk about Trey Gowdy because he knows about this. If you look at the model of how Nixon was removed from office, which he resigned, but he had no choice because he was toast, Democratic House and Senate, you know, since 72, you know, the five-minute break into the Watergate Hotel, bugging the Democratic Central Committee, blah, blah, blah. Pretty soon, it's deeper, deeper, way deeper. It's really a spying network. Deep Throat mentioned that. If you watch All the President's Men, they mentioned the grand jury about five times. You have to watch the Director's Cup to get this. All the while, it was an independent investigation by the Justice Department. They said, we find no wrongdoing. Oh, really? No wrongdoing? No. Nixon was untouchable at that time because he had just opened up trade negotiations with China. He had done a number of wonderful things, as well as getting rid of gold currency and, you know, EPA. So, but he was loved by the people. He was absolutely adored. And so they could pull this political media. Oh, you know, we spent 10,000 man hours, no wrongdoing as president. This is in early... I think it was January, February of 1974. Then what happened was the famous Watergate 7 indictment came out. March 5th, 1974, we had former Attorney General John Mitchell, Eric Mendelman Colson, who later went on to do awesome things, but Colson was second to the president. And they turned that result over to Congress. Congress, the House Judiciary Committee, said, look, I think they had two or three unanimous impeachment resolutions, Republican and Democrat. There were several more, the majority, but not unanimous. Nixon knew that this was going to go to the floor, and he resigned. I think it was August 9th, 1974, or August 6th. He knew the handwriting on the wall, and public sentiment had turned against him so bad. Now, what was the secret to this, using the grand jury? Under our right of petition, and it goes directly to a grand jury, hundreds of hours of research on that one, they whittled away, multiple grand juries whittled away at the Nixon administration. This guy was indicted. That guy was indicted. You know, G. Gordon Liddy was in, and it was a mess. And it got exposed. The public could see this. And the newspaper, Woodward and Bernstein of the Washington Post were on this. Again, watch All the President's Men, but this time notice it wasn't two men who were reporters who took out a president. It was a grand jury that made the shift. The grand jury was way ahead of them. So I have worked on a letter to Trey Gowdy. There's an attorney in New Jersey that hopefully she'll get with this. There's a guy in Florida who keeps calling me. Let's get another petition to a grand jury. And they are blocking it. The Justice Department, of course. Eric Holder is appointed by who? The president. Who does what? Eric Holder directs all these USAs or United States attorneys to block petitions. Daryl Issa mentioned that Holder has directed all of them to block petitions to grand juries. Go ahead and violate First Amendment right of petition. But there are ways through Moose Hunting Landmark case. We have found, I won't mention the case, it's too long to mention, but we have found a landmark case. We found other things. And we are going to go after them to get a judge to order that the petition be delivered to the grand jury. When, you know, pick one of these scandals. You got, you know, Fast and Furious. You got Irregeist. You got the Vets. You got blah, 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 blah. Okay, Benghazi, who cares? I don't say who cares, but there's so many. I wrote a letter to Trey Gowdy, and hopefully these two people will lobby Trey Gowdy because he gets it, the power of the grand jury. He was a federal prosecutor in front of a grand jury. Start whittling away at the cabinet. Start whittling away. Who knew what, where, when, how, why, the grand jury can get to it. When things start whittling away, it will change the tide in the Senate. The impeachment process is two-step. You're impeached, which is a fancy word for indictment, and then it goes to trial in the Senate. We need two-thirds. The Chief Justice presides. We don't have the votes right now for impeachment. We do not. But if the grand jury comes through, like I'm hoping to, and hopefully this young attorney, and there's another attorney that will help, we start whittling away at these jokers, just like the Nixon administration. We start whittling away. The Democrats are going to be in a position of, I better vote for this, or I will be voted out of office. So that is a very real possibility. It just takes more time. It can be done. It's been done before. The fourth branch can do this. And the fourth branch was created to hold the king, bad King John, to the principles of the Magna Carta. It's been done before. We can do it again. It just needs some serious effort and help and people willing to literally face retaliation when they submit these petitions.
Well, you know, that's what I'm worried about is what they're going to run up against when it is such a different world now than it was when Richard Nixon was impeached. So,
right.
Let me
go more into Trey Gowdy, okay? He and Ted Cruz, they've been screaming, where is the independent prosecution? Who prosecutes in front of the grand jury? Oh, that's right, somebody that ultimately, somebody's under Holder. So here's basically the letter I wrote. Look, Trey Gowdy, I know you're working on this. You know about the power of the grand jury. There are too many scandals for you to investigate. Get funding to convene more grand juries and let them ferret it out. And that's why we need these lobbyists and two people willing to do this. Basically, if you convene five or six grand juries, Watergate had like three, another report said five, if you get enough grand juries that are independent, know their power, have their own prosecution, funded by Congress, not the Senate, funded by Congress, we are going to see a huge shift.
Well,
what do you think about
point,
that, Peter? You think we'll see a shift?
You know, I'm concerned, like Cindy said, about the media, of course, against Nixon. The media's, the mainstream media is for Obama. You know, there's difficulties there, but I like the idea. Just forcing the rule of law, using the grand jury. This sounds good. I just wondered, how long is that process going to take? Are we already beat to 2016 before anything happens? I don't know, it just seems to me that. At least the House, not go to trial in the Senate, but the House, works hard with some good, strong leadership, which was not exercised by Speaker Boehner and by Cantor, House Majority Leader. I think some leadership might have pulled those votes together to actually impeach or indict President Obama. But you do what you can do, and maybe you do both those things. push the, as you suggested, the grand jury. So, you know, I got to go here, too. If I could, share one thing before I get off the phone here.
Certainly.
Yeah, I was getting back to our founding fathers pointed back to God and some Judeo-Christian values, and you know, I pulled out my I just realized that this whole thing with my Christian faith really governs my it makes me understand that with my freedom comes personal responsibility. And just if I could, there's this passage out of the First Peter is where this comes from. It says, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king as a supreme authority or to the governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. And then it goes on to say this, and I try to live by this. It says, live as free men, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as servants of God. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the brotherhood of believers. Fear God, honor the king. Well, in this case, you know, we the people are the sovereign, and we need to honor each other. So I'll just leave with that, Robert, before I sign off.
Hey, Peter, can I ask you something?
Sure.
Real quickly. Okay, we prayed before on the show. Can you just say a quick prayer for our nation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Dear Heavenly Father, I pray that, Father, will you just pour out your Holy Spirit upon our country? Lord, I do pray for those you placed in it, that we the people have voted for, Lord, use that way, that we placed into authority. I pray for President Obama. I pray that, Lord, you, Holy Spirit work in his heart. That, Lord, I pray that he'd fear you, that he would come to know Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. I pray for those on the Supreme Court who are making these decisions that affect all of us. I pray you give them the fear of God and give them wisdom, Lord. I just pray that you work in the our legislators, Lord, that they would know that they're there to represent all the people. And, Lord, that they need to work hard to secure the blessings of liberty to our posterity, Lord. And we need to deal with some real issues like the debt, Lord, which enslaves our children, our grandchildren, Lord. There's just so many issues pressing down upon us, Lord. And it's, Lord, we can be hopeless, Lord. We turn back to you. We know that as our founding fathers, Lord, we could trust in your divine providence, Lord. So I place our trust in you. And, Lord, I pray for the Holy Spirit on all the American people that, Lord, we would not live for ourselves, Lord, but we'd live for you and we'd love you and love others. Lord, I know that would solve many of the problems that we face today. Lord, just lift these things up to you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Robert, thank you, Peter, for coming on tonight and spending as much time with us as you have. And we look forward to, you know, throughout the campaign having you back and beyond. And also, yeah, I'll be keeping in touch and, you know, still looking to get Mr. Brad on to the show. I think it'd be really great to have him on here. I'm sure the audience and the panelists would enjoy that as well.
Well, I'll tell you what, Robert, I've been educated tonight. I appreciate the fellow guests there. And, you know, you're always sharpening me, so I appreciate that.
Oh, no, you're welcome. You take care, and good luck to you, and we'll speak again soon.
All right, have a good night, everybody.
Good night.
You too. Good night.
Bye.
Please. Take care.
Bob, if you don't mind, I'd like to comment on a couple of things that were just mentioned.
Oh, yeah, certainly I was going to bring
first
in.
All, oh, well, good timing. First of all, with this convention of states, I'm right with Cindy on this one and with Kelly. We don't want to have any amendments other than individual amendments, like getting rid of the IRS or the Federal Reserve, whatever, ratified in the usual way. Because when Peter said that, you know, Republicans control the majority of the state houses, and that's true. Pennsylvania has a Republican government. We have a Republican Senate. We have a Republican House. And what they've passed is progressive agendas because Pennsylvania, and I'm really, really upset about this because I'm a little competitive kind of guy. We only came in fifth. We're the fifth most corrupt state in the nation. So, you know, hey, we've got room for improvement. But just because somebody happens to call themselves a Republican or any other party doesn't make them a constitutional conservative. Now, one thing that Peter did mention was do the hard thing. And Cindy mentioned the dangers involved. And this is the 4th of July coming up. And it's not just a celebration of liberty and fireworks. It's a celebration of rebellion, of the commitment to fight for it. I came across on a website for Concerned Gun Owners of America. I'm working with the Pennsylvania chapter of that. A little article, and I'm going to just read excerpts, not the whole thing, because it's a little long. But I want to remind everybody about what happened to the 56 men who signed the Declaration. And these guys were the best and brightest, the very successful. 24 were lawyers and jurists. 11 were merchants, 9 farmers, large farmers and plantation owners. They had money, they had education, and they signed the Declaration anyway, knowing that the penalty would be death if captured. 5 signers were captured by the British as traitors. 5 of the 56 were tortured before they died. 12 had their homes ransacked and burned. 2 lost their sons serving in the Revolutionary Army. 2 had sons captured. 9 of the 56 fought and died from wounds served in the Revolutionary War. And some specific examples, just to make this real for you guys out there. Just imagine if this was a Bill Gates or a Warren Buffett who are doing the exact opposite with their power, with their money. Carter Braxton was from Virginia. He's a very wealthy man, a planter and a trader, and he had ships. He had a whole fleet, and they were taken by the British Navy. He paid his debts by selling his home and properties and died in poverty. Thomas McKean was forced to move his family constantly, served in Congress without pay, family in hiding, possessions taken from him. He left nothing in to his children in terms of money. It was all gone. He lost everything. The properties of Dillery, Hall, Clymer, Walton, Button Gwinnett from Delaware, Hayward, Rutledge, and Middleton were all looted by soldiers or vandals. Thomas Nelson, during a battle, noted that the British general, Lord Cornwallis, had taken over Nelson's home, and he told George Washington to open fire. His home was destroyed. He died bankrupt. Francis Lewis had his home and properties destroyed. The enemy took his wife, jailed her, and she died in a few months. John Hart was driven from his wife's bedside as she was dying, and their 13 children fled for their lives. He lost his fields and gristmill. For a year, he lived in forests and caves, and when he came back, his family was gone. No one ever really knew what happened. His wife died. His children vanished. These were best and brightest successful men, and they signed that as a commitment to freedom, to pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. Now, folks, I'm not trying to scare you. I'm trying to teach you a history lesson that's much older than Watergate. There is a significant chance, and it's better now than it was just a few months ago or a year ago or 2 years ago, that we can do this successfully, peacefully, orderly, properly, through grand juries, through impeachment, through taking back all of our political institutions and all of our civic institutions and all of our religious institutions from these progressive corruptocrats. We can take this back, and it might just win. But remember what the upside of this is if we don't. We're going to have a clear choice if we don't take the choice of being active now in whatever form you want. I've always said attack on all fronts. Whatever the issue of your heart is, that's where you attack and cooperate with all the others. Just like this event that's coming up on the 18th and 19th regarding immigration, there are hundreds of groups and more signing on every day, some bringing 500 people, some 5,000 people, and some many more than that. And they're finding that they have all this in common, even though this group might not be exactly the same as your group. They might have differing agendas. You might differ on certain points or tactics. You can work for this specific issue. And if we don't, we're going to have to fight. And if we fight, what happened to the best and the brightest and the richest and the most educated, the people who were most likely to survive and thrive, will happen to us. And remember that the Declaration was only the opening salvo officially of a war that had begun a year earlier in Boston that people were dying. Towns were burned, okay? This was a horrible, horrible situation. The war dragged on for years, from 1775 until 1783. That's a long time, and it was by no means a foregone conclusion. Any number of times, had we not had strategic victories or strategic losses that enabled the army to stay in the field, had we not gotten strategic support from the French, had any number of things not happened, just one of those things, we might be living in tyranny today. And so do you really want to risk that, folks? Aren't you willing to step up and do something? Peter Greenwald stepped up and ran for Congress. And, you know, they treated him in the press like crud. Mm-hmm. I mean, God, Lord knows the stuff that they said about him. I mean, I'm not prominent. I do a little things here and a little things there and as much as I can. And they're saying some stuff about me, which isn't very pleasant. And I don't care. Because what's my choice? My choice is to work as hard as I possibly can and get other people who want the same basic strategic goal of restoring liberty and restoring our Constitution to help them, to get them in the fight, to support them. Or what? My kid who's going to turn 21 and who's being handed an America that's a pale shadow of what I was handed when I was her age has nothing to look forward to, that perhaps one day if I become a grandfather, my child will be born into a serfdom or slavery because they have no rights whatsoever. Do we really want what the ultimate goal of all tyrants is, which is total control? And they will be gentle as they can, okay, unless they can't, unless they feel threatened. And that's what happens when people sell their souls for power. They get to a point where they will do anything to keep that power. And when they feel that there's a threat or a potential threat, they'll use that power. Look at North Korea today. That is the end result of what happens. And folks, I know you're saying North Korea, America. Well, look what's happening on our southern border right now. Look what's happening in the VA. Look what's happening with Obamacare. Look what's happening with the Benghazi investigation. Look what's happening across America. Look at the militarization of the police. Look at all these things and tell me honestly that there's absolutely no chance that we're heading down that path. And even if it never goes as far as North Korea or Stalinist Russia or Nazi Germany, is it really a path we want to take embark on? Because right now I can speak. I can travel freely. Right now, I can donate money, assuming I had any, and I can get involved with people, voluntary associations. If we lose that, just exactly what can I do? What can you do if you don't have the right, if you have to ask permission, if they can take that from you? The Supreme Court didn't just say you can't go into someone's cell phone without a warrant. They said stop going into people's cell phone without a warrant. They were already doing it. They're already seizing people's properties. There's a guy who just went to jail out west because he gathered some rainwater on his property. He's in jail.
That's a pet peeve of mine
ridiculous.
Right there. What the heck is that about?
That's about control, Cindy. That's about we have the power. We set a rule. You pissed us off. Therefore, we're going to enforce it on you. But they don't enforce those rules on their friends. But any of you out there who may work for government or may still support the government or who think, you know what, they're not going to do anything to me, I'm quiet, I don't bother anyone, just remember, if you have – it's not just enough to be a threat to them by speaking up or by taking action against statists. It's not enough. Remember, if you have something they want, they'll take action against you. And even if you have nothing they want and you don't bother them at all, they may decide to just make an example of you. In Nazi Germany, they didn't just, and Soviet Russia, and Chinese communism, and even crazy Idi Amin's regime, they didn't just pick on people who were real threats or potential threats. Sometimes when they'd knocked off enough of their threats with purges, they thought, you know, we better keep people on their toes. So they just rounded people up and shot them.
Well, and they also slaughter your ability to make any money, and so your family is going to be in poverty. I don't care who you are, whether you're a registered Democrat and you're loyal to their party and you, you know, follow all the rules that they, all the progressives have put down for you. You know, you can do everything, dot every I and dot and cross every T, and still you're going to suffer because you will have no ability to take care of your family. You will be reliant on the government to take care of your family. And, yeah, there's a lot of people who won't care about that, but there's a lot of people who are in the middle class right now who are going to care mm-hmm. about that once that ability is gone.
You know, those people who don't care about that, they got to remember that they're trusting somebody to provide for them when there's no motivation to provide for them.
Well, right now there's motivation. And how much they're getting now from the government will not be the amount they're getting once they take over completely and there's everybody is on the government.
Exactly. There's a motivation to buy votes and to buy acquiescence and to keep people apathetic and out of the game by giving them a semi-comfortable existence. They did a survey here in Pennsylvania where they added up all the benefits that a single mom working at a part-time job could get if she quit her job and actually took the welfare. And the kids, between food, clothing, housing, energy assistance, job training, car, they'll give you a car, Obama phones, medical, you name it. They actually ended up getting about $100,000 in benefits, which cost the government, cost us about $200,000, easy, okay, just to administer all this. So why would it be worth her while to go and work and really struggle? Why would it be worth her while to find a guy to be a dad to those kids and, you know, work and struggle like all the rest of us bill payers are? I'm paycheck to paycheck myself, when she can get far more. I mean, $100,000, and you don't even have to pay taxes on it. And it's pretty awesome just for filling out some paperwork. And pretty much that's all they ask. But Cindy's absolutely right. Once they don't need you anymore, you may find they don't need you at all. And if they still feel like they need you somewhat, you're going to be getting a slice of government cheese. And you're lucky if they give you a vitamin pill. And,
well, can I,
and don't
can
expect
I mention
more.
One more thing? Can I mention
Please.
One more thing while you're on that subject? You also are going to be part of those billions of people that they want to get rid of, because the New World Order elitists have very cleverly hidden their main agenda, but there are a few whistleblowers out there saying that there is an argument between them whether they want to reduce the Earth's population to between 500 million or will it be 1 billion. So with our population of 6 billion now, I think it is,
yeah.
What happens to the other 5 billion people? If you voted for Obama and you think you're going to be in good stead once his imperial administration is fully in place, or some other, you know, world leader will come on the scene and be the big chief. Once that is done, what is your role? Are you going to be one of the 5 billion people who are going to die because of different plagues that they allow to be unleashed, because of world wars, because of, you know, whatever their plans are? They've got a lot of different ways to get rid of us, but
you know,
what's
Cindy's got a point. And the point that, and this sounds really extreme, and I'm not going to say that it isn't an extreme idea, and it's certainly not one that would resonate with a lot of people as being likely. But let's do a little bit of logic on this, okay? Now, we think of, ordinary people think of wealth as something that grows, something that we can create. I can just simply take some clay and make a sculpture. I can take some parts and make a machine. I can go take some lemons and make lemonade. And if I can convince people to buy it or buy a service, you know, hey, I'm going to go and be a landscaper. All I need is a couple of mowers, you know, and a beat-up old truck, and I can build from there. And maybe in a while I get better mowers, hire some people, get bigger trucks. Next thing you know, I got a big business. And this is what we think of, okay? And that's a growing, constantly raising thing. Wealth is not a zero-sum game. If you look around wherever you happen to live, imagine what that looked like 100 years ago or 200 years ago. There was forest there, fields. There was nothing there, okay? That home that you're in, that car that you drive, the roads that you drive on, this is all created wealth, okay? And there's a great deal of wealth still left in this country. But now let's look at it from the point of view of somebody who wants power. They are unconcerned about a continual growing pool of wealth as long as they have enough to live as royalty, like some rock star does today or some hip-hop star, you know, and you have nothing. So they have power over you. If you think about what that means, if they've got a couple of mansions and a couple of yachts and a couple of planes, and they've got, you know, good, clean running water and plenty of good food, and they've got all the electronics they could want, and you have nothing, why do they care if the world is I hate to use that word, progressing, is developing and growing and the economy is constantly building? Why would they care? They're not interested in the same things we're interested in. People who want money, they want money. There's no amount that's ever going to satisfy them. People who want power want power. There's no amount that's going to ever satisfy them. But people who want a reasonable, free life, we can be unsatisfied to the point where we work harder, where we work smarter, where we invest, where we voluntarily chip our monies together to try and help out, to try and improve our communities, okay, to build new roads, to build new houses, to come up with new technologies. And if you look, it's really easy to find if you just go away from the mainstream media. Just go on YouTube. Look at all the – just put in inventions and see what pops up. There are so many bright people across the world, and not all of them have degrees, and not all of them are brilliant geniuses either. They're people who saw something that didn't exist before that made sense to them, and they took a little bit of a risk, and they tried to create something. And most of them failed, and they failed, and they failed. But some of them came up with ideas that we go, wow, that is so awesome. Where can I get one of those? And they get to be rich, but they're not looking to be rich. They're looking to improve things. They're looking to create things. That's what we want. So Cindy's idea, which I don't know if it's true, but there's an awful lot of reports out there that make me think that it just might be true. It makes sense from a logical point of view if you think about what the people who want power have been doing to us across the entire world. And it's so stark and clear here in America because the rest of the world did not live particularly free. So when their freedoms are eroded, you don't see too much of a difference. You can see it somewhat in Europe, but they were never all that free there ever. You can see it not at all, really, in Russia or in China because they never really had much freedom. They had a little bit. Now it's being eroded away. It's pretty much the same as it was, but here in America, we, from the start, from the very start, had liberty. And that doesn't mean being taking license. It doesn't mean being I can do whatever I want to whoever I want, whenever I want. Liberty with responsibility, which means you're accountable for your actions. And you can have your failures, but you also get to keep your rewards. That's why we see it so stark and clear. And even the young people. Okay, at this meeting tonight, there were some young people, the kids are old enough to be my kid, some maybe even a grandkid. And these folks, somehow, even though they didn't grow up with the same free America that I kind of had, which wasn't nearly as free as what my parents and grandparents had, they still know what the idea is. The idea is still there, and people want this idea. And I'll tell you what, people want money, people who want power will do what it takes to get those things. I'm counting on the fact that people who want liberty will do what it takes. And don't wait until we have to give our lives for this or take lives. I'm not sure which is worse.
Well, you know,
and before I bring real quick, Kelly wanted to make a comment, but of course, before though, since you brought it up about new inventions, definitely, folks, check out the affiliate page on the Bard's Logic Political Talk website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com, and check them out. We have the Go Sun Stove Solar Oven and also the composter there, so check that out. Those are some inventions that you were talking about there, Dan, so I think that's a great example. So good opportunity for me to bring those folks up tonight. So go ahead, Kelly, and then I think you had a comment there, and then we'll bring it over to you, Cindy.
Well, yeah, I wanted to read bits and pieces from the Declaration of Independence. And years ago I had a writing binge about what these men went through. They actually approved it on the 2nd. And, oh boy, after the day of business, could you imagine? You know, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were like best friends, and they died, by the way, on the same day, July 4th, 1826. Samuel Adams was a cousin of John Adams. Could you imagine being in a group of men, yeah, independence, and then you get alone? You know, like, what the heck did we just do? We just approved our own death sentence. And, of course, they'd probably go to the local taverns, and they'd probably be jeered and criticized, and, yeah, you guys are fools. You're going to go against the King of Great Britain. Yeah, good luck with that. They really didn't know the outcome. And, again, they signed their own death warrants. So I wanted to go ahead and read. I mean, obviously, we got the 4th coming up. I want to go ahead and read parts of the Declaration of Independence. And first, a quick question. What's the first word in the Declaration of Independence?
When?
Guess what the first word is? What?
No, it's when in the course of human events.
Oh, that's
there
right.
There you go, when. When is the first word in the Declaration?
That's,
all right,
that's
so this is stunning. I'm not going to go through the whole... Yeah, I'm not going to go through the whole thing because it takes too long, but there are the beginning couple paragraphs, and then you got the offenses of the king, and you got the end paragraph. It's just so stunning to read. Here we go. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. But among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But to secure these rights, governments are instituted amongst men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most like to affect their safety and happiness. For it is indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind is more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guard for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states.
To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. And I was pointing out a couple of them, prephrasing. You know, he's nullified our laws. He's made judges appointing to his will and pays them. He has revoked trial by jury. He has pulled people from here on purported and pretended offenses to be tried by British folk. He has housed people in our homes. He has sent hither a swarm of officers to harass and eat our substance. He has taxed us without our consent. He is basically making government arbitrary. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our towns, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is now hiring mercenaries to complete his work of despotism. In every single stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor we have been wanting in attention to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our immigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity. And we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice and consignity. We must, therefore, acquiesce to the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in friends, peace. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
Yes.
Awesome.
And honor is a word that means so much today that nobody even thinks about.
Mm-hmm. And Cindy, I know you want to chime in, so go ahead. And thank you very much, Kelly. That was great.
Yes.
Go ahead, Cindy.
I just wanted to expand a little bit on what Dan was talking about earlier, about what we were saying. The reason that I believe that, and by the way, Kelly, thank you. That's awesome. We all need to be reading that over and over again. the reason I've been looking at the things that have been going on around the world, and especially here in the United States, and it has to be more forced here. It's kind of happening in third world countries just because that's the nature of their governments. They're just very dictatorial, and almost anarchy in a lot of the third world countries. And so I understand that the world population could really be just wiped out in those areas very easily. But in the United States, it's not so easy to do that. It's not so easy to kill a prosperous person. You have to have a little more creativity in your thoughts. And I looked around the United States to see what's going on here and whether anything that's going on here could possibly be attributed to this idea that they want to get rid of tens of millions of us. And the first thing I noticed was what Monsanto is up to with their GMOs and their poisons and stuff. They are basically, by using their GMOs, taking over all the farmland in America. Even if a farmer has his own land and his own farm, he could even be a larger farmer. If a Monsanto GMO field is anywhere near his, it's going to contaminate his field, and then Monsanto can take him to court. This has already happened. Can take him to court and charge him for stealing their seed patent.
Right.
This is government sponsored, by the way. Congress and the president are protecting Monsanto. And if you look around, once they have control over all the farmland, and I mean through and by that, the government will have control. It will be just like what the communists did in Russia and China, where they killed tens of millions of people through starvation. These GMOs are already taking a lot of the nutrients out of our vegetables and things, and so our soil is being ruined also. And so that's one way that I see them taking our population out. Then when you look at these Latin American children that are showing up right now, and they are reported to have all kinds of diseases, and they're coming in here and being dumped here, and I see that the government is protecting that, forcing medical people to not say anything about it on pain of jailing, okay? This is their attempt to bring disease to our country, which can kill or make a lot of us unhealthy. And then you look at how AIDS is proliferating under the radar because of a lack of reporting in the media, because of militant homosexual behavior and their influence in the government. And you don't really have any idea how many people are dying of AIDS. We don't hold anywhere near enough inoculations for a pandemic. Our government's not even trying to prepare for us to be a part of a pandemic. You look at the water wells being closed off all over in communities all over. People are being forced onto city water. My brother-in-law and sister were one family who that happened to. They were forced off their well and onto city water. And you look at what's happening out west, where the barrels of water were now illegal. And in fact, you aren't even allowed to catch runoff of any sort. You're not allowed to alter the land around your home in order to catch a runoff. As Dan said earlier, this is about control. You can slowly poison a lot of people with city water, with no warning and complete anonymity. Allowing Muslim nations to have nuclear warheads. You got Pakistan, India, which is a great, like half of it is Muslim. And, you know, you've got Iran about to have it, and nobody's allowed to touch Iran. They've put a chain around Israel so that they can't even protect themselves. So it's really, and, you know, I got a bunch more things on my computer that I can't think of now, but when I look at the ways that our government are trying to help us, hurt us, excuse me, they're not just allowing it to happen. They're actually trying to get rid of us and to get rid of our wealth. It just glares in my face. Plus, I think about that guy, and now I can't remember his name, and I think all of you will remember this. There was a guy, he was called the pastor to the elite. And he has a YouTube account. He does speeches, and he talks about his role as a chaplain to some of these elite people in the CFR and Bilderbergers and places like that, and how they told him that this is part of their agenda, that the world population is just too much. It's uncontrollable, and the argument they give is that, you know, people get out of control when there's too many of them. You got that mass crowd thing, and so we've got to keep the population low enough to be controlled. So between him and all these things that are going on, when I hear reports that they're trying to whittle our population of our world down to 1 billion, I can totally see that being the truth.
Well, you know, Cindy, I'm thinking that, and this is a dark thought, and I could be wrong. I'm wrong on a lot of things. I sure hope I am here. I think that this is a series of fights that we're going to have to fight in the 22nd century, the century we're in right now. The first is the fight against the state to bring
Aren't
the state
under... Aren't we in the 21st century?
No, that was the 20th. That was is that right?
We're in the 21st century now, the 1900s.
Well, you know, I'm terrible with math. Seriously, that's not my strong suit.
Yeah, we're in the 21st
whatever we
century.
Are.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. But whatever we're at.
It's getting late. Actually, we only...
Yeah,
real
Kelly's
quick,
an engineer.
Yeah, there we
go.
Ahead, unfortunately, we only have about 15 minutes left, folks, left in that, so we're going to have to, unfortunately, get ready to wrap things up.
Well, that's a boring
well,
math detail. I won't. All right, anyway.
All right. Let me wrap this up briefly then, and with the series of fights I think that we may be facing, and this is really, really stretching it. I do like chess. I like to play the long game, and I do see a lot of what Cindy's saying as having some serious evidence behind it. The first fight that we have is the fight for our individual liberty against the state, to rein the state in, not to destroy it. We don't want to anarchy, but to bring it back under constitutional bounds. Then the fight is going to be an international fight. There's a war coming. There's too much power and too much friction for there not to be some sort of conflict. To remain as quiet as things have been is just highly unlikely, especially with China on the ascendancy and Russia flexing its muscles and Europe basically wimping out as they usually do, with the strongman of Europe being Germany at this point. With the ascendance of a caliphate under ISIS, which is now starting to take over the Middle East, we're in deep, deep trouble, and we'd better decide that we're going to have liberty here. Otherwise, we're going to be cannon fodder, and this is if I'm right. But then the next most difficult fight of all is going to be a fight because the state is not going to trust its own people. They're not going to trust their own drone operators or their own soldiers. Right now, and this is easy to find out, and Google's a big part of it, they're developing robots that are autonomous, armed machines that have more strength, more speed, more agility than any human being, that are heavily armed, that are going to be able to make their own decisions in the field. This is what DARPA, the defense research people, are actually, they publicly state this. They want this. And one of the smartest men in the entire world right now, Stephen Hawking, says that this is an extreme danger. The danger is, even if we're able to restore liberty in America, even if we're able to successfully defend ourselves against tyranny with extremely powerful military that is getting ready, that China is clearly getting ready, so is Russia, as we're getting weaker, we're going to have to defend mm-hmm. ourselves against autonomous machines. And see, computers always have a way of exceeding their programming. And if you don't think that, if you operate a computer, does it ever do stuff you didn't intend it to do? There are so many lines of code that have so many interactions that you can end up not knowing what the heck it's about. I used to be
a mechanic.
I worked on cars. I'll briefly finish this up. In the old days with mechanical devices, I could easily diagnose a car and find out by the step-by-step process what was wrong with it and take the part, figure out what part it was, and either fix it or replace it. With computerized cars, you can't do that because the symptom it's showing may have absolutely nothing to do with the part that is causing the symptom. It's so interactive and so convoluted that you get an unintended result. So we're in real trouble here, folks, and we have to start now. Maybe all this speculation isn't going to happen, but if you look at the evidence, it's foolish to ignore the possibility.
Well,
go ahead,
Robert.
Yep, and then we'll have to get ready to start shutting things down, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, I'm going to discuss computer programming and then rednecks. They didn't think about rednecks. All right. Computer programming, I've programmed in four languages. See, basic Fortran, focused database, and that's one other one. Anyway, programmers do exactly what I program it to. Every time I would find an error, it was my fault. Now, there are probably, you know, computer, it's yes or no. It's black and white, period. Anyway, I'm boring people, but so what if they have, so what? All right? You watch Star Wars? What did they do? They took it off autopilot. Okay? One of these sci-fi, you know. So when the guy took it off autopilot, he kicked ass. I mean, it was actually, I think, Battlestar Galactica. Anyway, it doesn't matter. One of these sci-fis. And there is no computer program that can match the flying skills of a live pilot who can read the situation, which is there is no way a computer can be programmed to handle the thousands and thousands of different possibilities that can happen. You can't. Only the human mind can do that. Enter in rednecks. So what? They got this drone that'll do 30 miles an hour. I don't care. All you got to do is run it over with your truck. And if you don't run it over, you certainly damage it that it can't do diddly squat. They don't think about rednecks. They're some of the smartest people I know. Why? Because they operate in common sense. And reading the situation, like basketball. Basketball, what? You can't computer program a basketball player. Why? Because every situation is different. Every field shot is different. Basketball players know how to read what's going on, and they put the ball in. But every situation, ironically, I mean, yeah, okay, there's some standard stuff, but there are stuff you cannot program because it's a human element. And the rednecks, they'll get tired enough. They'll just think and take their truck, put some armor plating on it, and run over the damn drone, or at least dent it so it can't do diddly squat. So you've got what? I mean, my truck, I bought it for $700. You know? And this drone was, what, $50,000? I mean, we're talking, how did we help Afghanistan beat the Russians? We were, you know, the Stinger missile, we were training them how to use it, and we made it user-friendly, but the Russians were spending dollar bills, $5 bills, $10 bills, and we were supporting the Stinger and some of the other new tech and other stuff. We were spending, you know, nickels and dimes, and then the Russians ran out of money, and pretty soon, you know, the Soviet Union, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. We use rednecks and low-tech versus the high-tech of the Russians. And those and the powers be, they are so filled with hubris. Hubris is woeful pride, off-the-charge pride, delusional pride. That's hubris. And they don't have a stinking clue. And that's why I'm not so worried about these, except for the things that fly. But on the ground, they can't do. They're just going to get defeated.
Well, the Bible does say that they that all that stuff happens too. So that's why I also tend to believe it, that it's going to happen, because it's prophesied.
Well, so. it does, you know, it does describe a grasshopper-like thing, which would be, you know, like an Apache helicopter, but you still got to control the ground.
And folks, with that, I'm going to have to close things down. We only have a few minutes, and plus my device here that I had to use tonight because of my carrier is not working right, so I had to use an alternative means of calling into the show tonight, and the battery attached to it is about to die with the ending of the show. So we'll have to go ahead and things down. It's beeping, warning me it could shut off, so I don't want to leave everyone with just it hanging up. So I would like to thank everybody for coming in tonight and coming into the show. And we look forward to seeing everyone next week on the 9th with former Congressman Trev Kant will be on. And I want to wish everyone here listening to the show, whether live or on the archive, and, of course, you all here, a very happy 4th of July. I hope everyone has a safe holiday. And so I'd like to thank everybody again. And please share the link, whether it's on Facebook or Twitter, or email the folks here on the show tonight, and we will see you next week. And so, once again, sorry, folks, for have to shut things off early, but I didn't want it to just shut down on us without saying goodnight. So you guys, folks, care, and we will see you then. And, of course, I will end the show as I do every night. And that
hey,
is
Robert.
The so, yeah.
Hey, Robert. I
yes,
would encourage everybody to take 10, 15 minutes and read the Declaration of Independence on the 4th. And maybe if you like to, read it to your friends.
We'll do that.
That's a good
Very
idea.
Very good idea. Great idea. Great idea. Awesome. Well, here is the song by Aubrey Ashburn, and you can hear more of her music by going to www.aubreyashburn.com. And, of course, check out the Patriot Journalist Network at www.patriotjournalist.com. And also, the Bard's Logic Political Talk website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. So take care, everyone, and good night.
Good night.
Night.